The U.S. says Russian hackers have targeted American utility companies for cyber attacks.
Since about 2011, they primarily have focused on the energy sector.
Just ahead, whether Russia is capable of taking out American power grids. It's Friday, March 16th, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead this hour, Russia is the biggest country in the world by landmass, and which part Russians live in may guide whether they'll vote for Vladimir Putin in the election this Sunday. Today, Saudi Arabia's crown prince begins a tour of the U.S. to drum up foreign investment. Maybe a hard sell after 200 princes and wealthy businessmen were detained at a luxury hotel in Riyadh for months as part of the prince's anti-corruption campaign. And reality TV is popular around the world. We'll look at a U.N.-backed reality show called Inspire Somalia, tried to model democracy and freedom in a country racked by clan warfare.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House is rejecting any notion of growing instability in the West Wing in light of recent dismissals and resignations from its highest ranks. On word that it's looking at replacing National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said no personnel changes were planned at this time. As it prepares for direct talks with North Korea, the administration is criticized for not having a U.S. ambassador to South Korea or naming a nominee. Well, in today's White House press briefing, Legislative Affairs Director Mark Short blamed Senate Democrats for blocking President Trump's nominees.
At this rate, the United States Senate would take 11 and a half years to confirm our nominees.
Meanwhile, the White House is responding to claims from an attorney for Stormy Daniels that she's been threatened with physical harm for talking about her alleged affair with Donald Trump in 2006. The press secretary says it condemns anyone threatening any individual. Daniels' allegations have raised questions about whether President Trump was aware of a $130,000 payment to her to keep quiet. New York Democratic Congresswoman Louise Slaughter, the oldest member of Congress and the first woman to chair the powerful House Rules Committee, has died at the age of 88. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan says Slaughter did not need a gavel to make a dent in history. Slaughter championed the rights of women and people of color. She was a driving force behind a 2012 law that banned insider stock trading based on congressional knowledge. And more than a year ago, she reflected fondly on passage of the Affordable Care Act.
I'm Louise Slaughter from New York, and I'm extraordinarily proud that as chair of the Rules Committee, I was able to bring this wonderful ACA bill to the floor. It's one of the proudest moments of my life.
Slaughter's chief of staff says the New York Democrat sustained a concussion when she fell while she was at her Washington, D.C. home a week ago. She passed away today at George Washington University Hospital. A bill that would ban most child marriages in Kentucky has passed the legislature and awaits the governor's signature. Kentucky Public Radio's Rylan Barton says the state currently has no lower age limit for marriage.
Right now, Kentucky law allows judges to approve marriages of girls younger than 16 as long as they're pregnant, and 16 and 17-year-olds can get married with parental permission. Under Senate Bill 48, Kentucky's legal marriage age would be raised to 18 years old. 17-year-olds would still be able to get married with a court order. Kentucky has the third highest rate of child marriage in the country. More than 11,000 minors, some as young as 13, have been wed in the state since 2000. The bill was held up in committee amid resistance from conservative groups who argued parents should have more authority in the process. For NPR News, I'm Rylan Barton in Frankfort, Kentucky.
Before the close, U.S. stocks were trading higher, with the Dow up 72 at 24,946. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Two Democratic state lawmakers publicly accused Massachusetts House leadership yesterday of trying to silence former employees who had been harassed in the workplace. Well, today the Speaker of the House is defending the branch's use of non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs. More now from WBUR Steve Brown at the State House.
Speaker Robert DeLeo says the House has never used a non-disclosure agreement, or NDA, relative to any sexual harassment cases. As to Representative Diana DeZoglio's claim that she felt she had no choice but to sign an NDA after she was terminated as a legislative aide 7 years ago, DeLeo said she entered into the agreement with the advice of her own attorney.
She seemed to be pleased in terms of the outcome when it occurred. So in terms of her being pressured, I've got no idea about that.
DeLeo says it's important for confidentiality to be available for the victims of workplace harassment.
Have a technical problem there from Steve Brown. The complete story later on. A second-degree murder conviction will stand in the killing of a 2-year-old girl whose remains washed up on Deer Island in Boston Harbor. Today, a judge in Boston rejected a motion from Michael McCarthy to have his conviction reduced to manslaughter in the 2015 death of Bella Bond. The defense had argued that the girl's mother was the real killer. Prosecutors argued the verdict was fair and grounded in evidence. Organizers of the South Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade say they're working to preserve its traditional route for future years. Mayor Marty Walsh shortened the route for Sunday's parade, citing the recent snowfall and concerns about public safety. The South Boston Allied War Veterans Council says it disagrees with that decision, but will go along with it this time as it considers what to do about next year and beyond that. Massachusetts colleagues of the late New York Congresswoman Louise Slaughter are expressing their condolences today. The 88-year-old Democrat died today after falling in her home last week. Congresswoman Catherine Clark says Slaughter broke ground for women in public service. Congressman James McGovern says that she will be remembered for pushing historic bills such as the Affordable Care Act. Boston Celtics visit the Orlando Magic tonight. Bruins play Tampa Bay tomorrow. In the forecast, clear overnight tonight, down in the 20s. Tomorrow, more clouds than sun, right around the mid-30s. And then Sunday, heavier on the sunshine, back in the mid-30s. 38 degrees now in the Boston area at 6 past 4.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Focus Features and Participant Media, with 7 days in Entebbe, about the 1976 rescue mission when four hijackers took a plane with 248 hostages. Inspired by true events, starts today.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Moscow, where I am gauging Russian reaction to all the news you've been following there in Washington this week.
Boy, good timing, Mary Louise. There's been a whole lot of that news about Russia over these last few days.
There has indeed. To review, there's the sanctions that we know the Trump administration imposed yesterday, which the Kremlin is displeased over because they continue to insist that they did not interfere in U.S. elections. Also, Ari, that they didn't carry out cyber attacks on the U.S. power grid. Oh, and by the way, they did not poison the former Russian spy and his daughter in Britain. That's
all
the line
that.
Here in Russian. No. And meanwhile, we got this whole presidential election going on. So we've got lots more on that later in the program. But let me hand it back to you for now for our weekly discussion about U.S. politics.
Okay. Looking forward to hearing more from you in a bit, Mary Louise. But first, for that weekly political discussion, we have Mary Catherine Hamm, senior writer at The Federalist. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And also here in the studio, Kimberly Atkins, reporter and columnist at The Boston Herald. Hi again, Kimberly.
Hi there.
Let's start with that U.S.-Russia relationship and the sanctions that the White House announced this week. Do you think those sanctions, that acknowledgement by the Trump White House, shows that this president has finally caught up with his intelligence community and the agreement that Russia interfered with the 2016 elections? Kimberly?
I think not quite yet. I mean, you saw even after the announcement of these sanctions, which are the toughest sanctions that this administration has handed down against Russia so far, there still is not a willingness to say for certain, unequivocally, that Russia is a bad actor. You saw Sarah Huckabee Sanders still saying, well, it depends on what Russia does from here on in. You know, you saw the president not really talk about the sanctions or the actions that Russia has taken against the U.S., even when he was talking about this poisoning in the U.K. That the U.S. issued a joint statement condemning. So it still seems to be a hesitancy there to fully embrace that.
Mary Catherine, how do you interpret these sanctions?
I mean, well, there are, well, first of all, it's a big step to recognize that not only have they gone past the disinformation campaign, but into actual infrastructure, which is a huge deal. And so
yeah,
to recognize that with actual action is big. I do think Trump is willing to admit that for a moment, and then he might change his mind later. Mm-hmm. Other folks in the administration, H.R. McMaster, Nikki Haley, even Mike Pompeo, who will now be Secretary of State, have been much harder on this line. So you've got this strange dichotomy where at times the Trump administration is quite tough on Russia substantively with closing a consulate in San Francisco or with these sanctions, but you do not have a united front because the leader is missing in action and has sometimes been far too kind to Putin.
Let's move on from the U.S. relationship with Russia to this dramatic week of staff changes, from the Secretary of State being fired in a tweet to a close personal aide to the president apparently being deemed a risk to national security and walked out of the White House. Last night, there were some headlines that the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, was going to be ousted immediately, then maybe not so immediately. This afternoon, here's what Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said.
The chief of staff actually spoke to a number of staff this morning, reassuring them that there were no immediate personnel changes at this time and that people shouldn't be concerned.
At this time. Mary Catherine, how do you think this turmoil affects President Trump's agenda?
Well, I think it makes it hard to focus on something like, say, Infrastructure Week, which we've tried several times now.
Right.
Look, the Trump White House does operate differently, just as the Trump organization operates differently. This is how he likes to manage, and I'm not sure it's that effective. It's like the online dating app of White Houses. There's a lot of heat and fire, not a lot of thought about compatibility, very little vetting, and in the end, you get ghosted or texted to be dumped.
Or tweeted.
But yeah, it's not a great way of doing business. I don't think it helps him actually move legislation and goals forward.
Kimberly, President Trump says this is how he enjoys working. So what's wrong with that?
Well, it is how he enjoys it. I think he is fine with this setup, even if the people around him are kind of flailing in this chaos. Remember, he came from The Apprentice. He likes being at the table and saying, you're fired. And I think he's more comfortable being in that position, going with his gut, with his instincts, than necessarily relying on people around him who later on, as we've seen in many instances, he can regret following other people's advice and wishing he would do stuck to his own guns.
I will say often his second choice is a more compatible choice that actually ends up being more functional, a Kelly at chief of staff, and I think Pompeo likely at secretary of state. So there is that.
I also want to talk about this week's special election in Pennsylvania. On Tuesday, Connor Lamb, the Democrat, apparently just barely won this district that President Trump carried by more than 20 points. Kimberly, do you think this one special election should redefine the way Democrats and political observers go into the midterm elections?
I think they should pay careful attention to it. Look, I always say special elections are special. They are they measure what's happening on the ground more than the national feeling. But in this sense, there's a lot to draw from it. There is an anti-Trump sentiment that can be palpable here. It's about choosing good candidates. Connor Lamb seemed to be the perfect candidate for this district at this time. And it brings in, you know, this idea of how strong Trump will be if he's going out on the campaign trail for the midterms like he promises he will. Will this be a get out the vote effort for the Democrats?
Yeah.
It's really a lot of things at play here. And I think both parties need to pay careful attention to that race.
The line we heard this week from Republicans like House Speaker Paul Ryan was that the Democrat ran as a Republican, as a conservative. Mary Catherine, does that give any consolation to the Republicans who appear to have lost this race?
Look, he did run as a moderate Democrat, and I do think that's something Democrats should pay attention to. Notably, he was not picked by primary, so it wasn't progressive activists and that energy that was working on his behalf. It was, you know, committee sort of chairman who did that, and I think that's how you got a more moderate candidate. But what you can't ignore is that the swing away from Republicans toward Democrats in every special election has been uniform, right? That's the problem for Republicans. There's a real issue there, they can't rely on Democrats to pick two liberal candidates in every single race.
Just briefly in our last minute, in Washington and across the country this week, we saw students walk out of school to protest gun violence. Do you both think we're seeing a new political movement here, or is this just a moment?
I think we're seeing a cultural change. I think people are finally looking at guns and gun violence, particularly in schools, in a new way that can help change sentiment. I don't think that can come from the Capitol, from lawmakers. I think it comes from communities, and these students are an example of that.
Last word, Mary Catherine.
Yeah, I think the question is always whether this is social media and media fire, but doesn't actually lead to change. I think that's the question. And as a lifelong contrarian, I'm also worried about dissenting voices. And when you're up against the behemoth of your school administration sort of pushing this and national media pushing it, my best wishes to those who might have disagreements on these policies and not walk out or walk with a different sign. I support them as well.
Mary Catherine Hamm, senior writer at The Federalist, thanks very much for joining us. And Kimberly Atkins, reporter and columnist for The Boston Herald. Good to have you both here.
Thanks
Always
very much.
A pleasure.
Now, a correction to a story we aired Wednesday about Gina Haspel, the woman President Trump plans to nominate for director of the CIA. We spoke with a reporter for ProPublica who'd investigated Haspel's role at a secret CIA prison where terrorism suspects were interrogated. Last night, ProPublica retracted key details of that report. To correct the record, we spoke today with ProPublica's editor-in-chief, Stephen Engelberg.
Any suggestion that she had a direct or personal involvement in the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah, which is quite an infamous thing in the history of intelligence. You know, he was waterboarded some 83 times. That would not be correct. The chief of base turns out to have been a different person, and so any suggestion that she was directly and personally involved in that is incorrect.
In fact, Gina Haspel became chief of base at the prison in Thailand after Abu Zubaydah's waterboarding. ProPublica now reports that she was present for the interrogation of a different detainee who was waterboarded three times. There are still questions about her role in the destruction of tapes showing Abu Zubaydah's waterboarding. The ProPublica journalist Raymond Bonner based his incorrect account on three sources he believed were knowledgeable. This week, people who worked with Haspel began to defend her, including James Mitchell, a psychologist and CIA contractor involved in the Abu Zubaydah interrogation. Some of the ProPublica reporting was based on his book, Enhanced Interrogation. Today, Mitchell spoke to me about the retracted ProPublica report saying Haspel mocked Abu Zubaydah's physical reaction to the interrogations.
That's completely untrue. I mean, it's 100% untrue. They mischaracterized the event. They misattributed who I was referring to. I know who I was writing about, and I know the incident that I was writing about, and she wasn't involved in it.
Mitchell explained why, on this occasion, he felt the need to speak out.
I'm doing it in this particular case because they were using something that I wrote to smear a woman who is the best choice that this nation could have for that position.
Before the story was first published last February, ProPublica asked the CIA for comment, and the agency responded that nearly every element of the story was inaccurate in whole or part, but would not specify which elements. Here's Engelberg of ProPublica.
That kind of blanket statement is sometimes, or indeed often, delivered by people who are, not being honest in what they're saying. You know, there's some very small error somewhere, and they're saying, well, the story has errors, so, we deny it. And in this case, what was going on was very different. They were trying to steer us away from a story that was incorrect. I guess you'd have to ask them why on earth they wouldn't just say she wasn't there.
Today I put that question to Dean Boyd, a CIA spokesperson, and he told me he thought the agency's on-the-record statement was quite clear.
I will just say that we do operate in a difficult situation where we are not able to comment on specific details that may or may not be classified. We can push back strongly, and I think this was a pretty clear indication that there were errors in the story, but in many cases we're not able to go into much more detail given classification issues.
I asked ProPublica's Engelberg how he views this major lapse in the context of a long journalistic career.
Well, you know, when we cover medicine, we talk about sometimes what they call never events, you know, like operating on the wrong limb. I believe in journalistic practice, this is a never event. This should never happen. And I would never accept the notion that this is just something that's going to happen from time to time.
That's Steven Engelberg, editor-in-chief of ProPublica, which has retracted significant portions of its reporting on Gina Haspel.
Looking for a great night out? Every Thursday, Amelia Mason of WBUR's The Artery gives you five great recommendations. Check it out now at wbur.org/artery.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by North Shore Medical Center, where spine specialists use surgical and non-surgical treatments to help patients relieve pain and restore mobility. Learn more at nsmc.partners.org. And Xfinity X1, with a remote that lets you find your favorites with your voice. Search by show, actor, or genre. More about X1 at Xfinity.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR on Wall Street. U.S. stocks ended up gaining ground for the day. Finished up at 0.29%. The Dow did about 73 points to close at 24,947. S&P gained 0.17% to close at 2752. And the NASDAQ ended up where it began at 7482. Marketplace has details at 6:30 tonight. It's now 19 past 4.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Greeno Brand Storytellers, messaging, media, and marketing professionals for the healthcare, life sciences, and robotics industries, greenough.biz. And Cityside Subaru in Belmont, providing sales and service of Subaru vehicles to urban, suburban, and rural drivers alike. CitysideSubaru.com, the beauty of all-wheel drive.
So you get the weekend forecast now from meteorologist Dave Goldbaum.
Skies will clear out tonight. It'll be cold with a low near 25 by morning. For Saturday, considerable cloudiness, some intervals of sunshine at times, high 34. Sunshine for Sunday, still chilly, high again 34. Sunny on Monday, mid-30s. Clouds increase Tuesday with a chance for some snow Tuesday night with highs in the upper 30s.
38 degrees now in the Boston area. This is 90.9 WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Care.com, offering HomePay, a solution for nanny tax obligations, from payroll processing to state and federal tax filings. Learn more at care.com/NPR. And Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Moscow. It's just days before the Russian presidential election, and the office of Golos is jam-packed. Golos is the Russian word for voice. It also means vote, a fitting name for an independent election watchdog group. Every surface here is buried under pamphlets for volunteers, boxes of voting guides.
Should I speak English?
Roman Udot helps run Golos. He invited me to his office to talk about what it means to observe an election in Russia.
Let me show you. Okay.
I'll just explain. We're just watching on your laptop here. And you are pulling up. This is video of a polling station in 2016. Where are we? Is this Moscow?
Yeah, it's Kazan region.
The minutiae of voting in Russia will sound familiar if you've ever voted in America. People here in Russia generally cast their ballots at a school or another public building near their home. They put a check next to their preferred candidate's name, then slip the paper through a slot into a secure ballot box. At least, that is how it's supposed to work. He's putting his ballot down into the ballot box. He walks away.
Behold.
In from the right.
Behold.
More people are put. Oh my God, they've just opened the ballot box.
They took it from under their clothes. They stuff it, stuff and stuff it.
It's 1, 2, 3, 4 people pulling ballots out. Yeah. Jackets.
Yeah. And the reaction of the commission, reaction of the chair of the commission.
Now, each polling place has a government-mandated security camera that rolls nonstop on election day. But the tapes rarely see the light of day. So Golos depends on whistleblowers to send in footage that shows fraud. Or people can send pictures or call a toll-free number. Golos also deploys volunteer election observers, thousands of them, all over the country to keep an eye on polling places. When you're watching for fraud, when you're watching for falsification, is that how it tends to happen? Just more ballots are getting counted than people had showed up to vote?
You'll see that it is a ballot box stuffing, multiple voting. You multiple vote on one given polling station or merry-go-round carousel when people goes from polling station, and we have videos.
This was not the work that Golos set out to do. When the group was formed in 2000, they were a bunch of statistics wonks, collecting raw data on voter turnout and writing reports based on that data. But 2000 was the same year that Vladimir Putin was first elected president. And Roman Udot says that each year since that election, reports of fraud have increased. Those math wonks, they couldn't trust the data anymore. And so Golos got a new mission.
We observe the growing level of falsification. We can prove that and with facts. We can prove that with statistical data. We're sort of a watchdog, and we began to draw attention to bug. And that sound was very unpleasantly received by the government. Of course, they are not happy when we are showing the problems in elections, because elections are the source of their power.
Elections are the source of the regime's power. Make elections seem free and fair, win by wide margins, and you've got a mandate to govern. You've also got incentive to shut down independent groups like Golos. The day after we spoke with Roman Udot, the group was evicted from a call center they had set up in another neighborhood. The landlord told Udot, "We have no choice. They made us do it." So this Sunday, if you live in Moscow, if you live in precinct 1096, this is where you're going to come vote. They are ready for about 1,500 voters. I'm at this neighborhood school with Irina Belia, a sweet-looking grandmother in her early 70s. She runs this polling station. On Sunday, she'll get to the school at 7 a.m., 1 hour before the polls open. She'll organize the ballots, inspect the list of registered voters, set up the table where she'll oversee what's going on. Irina Belia will be watching, but she will be watched as well. Election observers, like the ones Golos sends all over the country, pay close attention to the people who run precincts. Belia gets it, because she used to be an election observer herself. It is cold out, about 25 degrees in front of this school, so we head to Balia's apartment nearby.
Okay, she wants to take us on a tour of her house.
Okay. So, pictures of her?
This is her and her husband.
After the grand tour, we settle in at her dining room table to chat. Balia is walking me through the nuts and bolts of voting in Russia when it becomes clear she has quite a story about volunteering during the 2011 parliamentary elections.
We were observers, but we were not truly allowed to observe. They kept us out of the way, so we couldn't see anything. But then I accidentally passed a ballot box, and I witnessed the vice president of the committee stuffing 23 ballots into one of the boxes. I tried grabbing them from him, but he pushed me away. So I kept trying, and finally I was able to snatch them from him. But he cut his hand, and blood spilled on the ballots and on the floor. It looked like a thriller scene.
And so what did you do? You complained?
Yes, of course. I was holding the ballots in my hands, and I was afraid to put them down. The people who ran the polling station approached me. They wanted me to hand them the ballots, but I refused. I said I will give them only to a court official. Even the police came up to me, but I said, I won't give them to you. I'll give them only to the judge.
Belia took the bloody ballots to the courts, but the prosecutor refused to look into what had happened. She continues to speak out about what she witnessed at the polling station that day in 2011. I ask, does that put her in danger? This soft-spoken grandma stares me in the eye and raises her fists in the air.
I recall a passage from the book Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, where he wrote, "Why did those arrested on the streets? Why didn't they shout? They were told, 'Hush, hush, get into the car,' and then they disappeared." And when that member of the committee told me the same words, "Hush, hush, don't shout," I said out loud, "Oh, you think this is shouting? I will show you what shouting is." I went to the center of the room and started screaming. Here, here, look. I think that the way you combat fraud and you fight lies is by speaking up.
In 2013, Belia decided to take the job running her local polling place. It's a government-funded position. The pay is about $1 an hour. The work is part-time. Belia figured if she couldn't get authorities to care about fraud as an election watcher, she'd try to prevent the fraud in the first place by being in charge. Like nearly everyone else we've talked to in Moscow, Belia has no doubts about who will win on Sunday. So why get involved with the process? Why vote at all?
Can one person make a difference? Everyone says I cannot change anything on my own. That's what the majority thinks.
Not voting is giving up, she says, and she is not ready to give up just yet. Irina Belia. She'll be in charge this weekend at Moscow Voting Precinct 1096.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. Sky should clear up tonight. Temperature should head downward toward the mid-20s. Tomorrow, generous on the clouds. The sun showing up from time to time. Highs only in the mid-30s tomorrow. For Sunday, should be the sunnier of the weekend days. Still chilly, though, in the mid-30s again. Same thing for Monday, mainly sunny. Cloudy on Tuesday, and there is the chance of some snow Tuesday night. Too soon to say right now, though, just how much. 38 degrees in Boston. The time is 4:30.
Funding for WBUR weather reports comes from GEICO, offering the GEICO mobile app. which stores ID cards and enables bill pay and claim reports directly from your cell phone. Learn more at geico.com. Other supporters include College Vine, mentors selected from Yale, UCLA, Rice, and more help with college lists and the application process. Learn more at collegevine.com.
From movies to music to television, there are people you think you know or want to know better. I'm Jeff Edgers, host of Edge of Fame from The Washington Post and WBUR, inviting you to come hang out with me, David Letterman, Issa Rae, and other amazing people each week. That's Edge of Fame, before, behind, and beyond the spotlight. New episodes every Thursday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. After 14 months in office, and President Trump continues to shake up his administration, seeking folks more in line with his policies, former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, who was fired this week, is just the latest casualty of the administration, with talks now swirling that National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster might be the next head to roll. Today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders tried to ease some of the tension staff may be feeling.
The chief of staff actually spoke to a number of staff this morning, reassuring them that there were personnel changes, no immediate personnel changes at this time, and that people shouldn't be concerned. We should do exactly what we do every day, and that's come to work and do the very best job that we can. And that's exactly what we're doing. That's exactly what we're focused on.
The president and H.R. McMaster have disagreed on a number of issues, including the Iran deal and the best approach to handling North Korea's threats. In Syria, civilians who survive years of life under siege in eastern Ghouta are still struggling to escape a government offensive. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports on an attack in one town that claimed dozens of lives.
Activists in Kafr Batna film corpses lined up on a concrete floor. The bodies are charred, burned beyond recognition. The footage was posted online after residents said fighter jets belonging to the Syrian regime or its ally Russia dropped bombs and incendiary weapons on the town. Doctors from the Syrian American Medical Society said they were treating patients for severe burn wounds. And both this charity and rescue volunteers from the White Helmets Group said over 40 people have died so far. The attack comes amid a ground offensive by the Syrian government and its allies to take back control of this area near the capital, Damascus. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Beirut.
Stocks finish higher on Wall Street. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Massachusetts House Speaker Robert DeLeo is defending the chamber's use of non-disclosure agreements. Yesterday, two state lawmakers accused House leadership of using the agreements to silence former employees who were harassed on Beacon Hill. DeLeo says none of the non-disclosure agreements that were signed when he was speaker involved sexual harassment cases.
I think in today's and yesterday's business world, I think my role as speaker, I think Jim Kennedy's role as House counsel is to make sure that we do best we can in terms of representing the House. Other people have other counsel, and I think it's just part of doing business.
Speaker DeLeo says people who are victims of workplace harassment should have the option of keeping things confidential. The cost of attending Berklee College of Music is on the rise. The school's board has approved a 2.6% increase in tuition, fees, and room and board. The total cost of attendance, including room and board, will increase to $62,500 this fall. Berklee says it's also boosting the amount of scholarships and financial aid it hopes to offer. Don't count on the luck of the Irish to get you to the St. Patrick's Day Parade on Sunday. The MBTA is warning of big crowds at the parade's starting point, the Broadway T station, and is encouraging people to watch from another spot. Buses won't stop at Broadway or Andrews stations, and trains might skip Broadway altogether if it's too crowded there. The MBTA will run a shuttle bus between South Station and the parade route. The husband and wife owners of Porter Square Books in Cambridge say they will avoid selling eventually to an outside party and pass the business along to their employees. David Sandberg and Dina Mardell have sold half their share of the bookstore to a group of 9 senior staff members. Sandberg says he and his wife aren't retiring anytime soon, but they want the future owners to be people who care about the store.
Every business wants its employees to be invested figuratively in the success of their business, and this is a way to get them invested literally as well as figuratively.
Sandberg says bookstores like his usually can't pay employees enough to buy the stores they work for. The 9 staff members will have the chance to purchase the other half of Porter Square Books when the current owners retire. The time now is 4:34.
WBUR supporters include certificates in real estate studies at BU's Center for Professional Education. Stay current and competitive in commercial real estate, facilities management, and real estate finance. Attend an info session on campus March 20th at 6 p.m. BU.edu/professional.
Tonight, the Celtics are likely to be without Kyrie Irving once again when they play Orlando. He's out with a sore knee for a second game. Al Horford is expected to be back on the court. And tomorrow, the Boston Bruins play Tampa Bay. In the forecast, clear and breezy overnight tonight, down in the 20s. For tomorrow, look for generally cloudy skies, some sunshine, highs in the mid-30s. Sunny on Sunday, highs in the mid-30s again. Right now in the Boston area, 38 degrees. This is WBUR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform with over 18 million monthly users designed to connect people from anywhere in the world on any device. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And T. Rowe Price, offering a strategic investing approach for their clients' investment and retirement goals. Institutions, advisors, employers, and individuals choose T. Rowe Price for over 80 years. T. Rowe Price. Invest with confidence.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Moscow, reporting on the presidential election they are about to hold here in Russia. Vladimir Putin is running, and guess what? He's expected to win, which is not stopping his opponents from going through the motions of campaigning. Here's the scene last night at Adrenaline Stadium here in Moscow. Without you, nothing is possible. Support me. That's Ksenia Sobchak, one of the 7 candidates running against Putin this Sunday. Sobchak supporters did turn out for her rally here last night. We watched them waving white flags with the slogan, Spring is Coming. But Sobchak is polling at around 1 or 2%. In fact, no candidate besides Putin is polling in the double digits. Well, let's bring in our Moscow correspondent, Lucian Kim, who has spent the day not in Moscow, but in Yekaterinburg, Russia's 4th largest city. Hey, Lucian.
Hey.
So I should explain to people, Yekaterinburg is about 1,000 miles east of Moscow, a few hundred miles north of Kazakhstan. What's the scene like there a couple days before the election? Any last-minute campaign rallies, protests? What are you seeing?
No, nothing like that. I mean, the only sign that there's an election is that there are posters everywhere reminding people to go out and vote. Russian presidential campaigns are not anything like what we know in the United States. Putin basically held one big rally in Moscow.
One big rally, the whole campaign?
Yes, one big rally in Moscow, and then he showed up in Crimea earlier this week, where he also spoke for 2 minutes. This is really a fake election campaign. None of the candidates expect to win, including Ksenia Sobchak. They're really just decoration. There was only one candidate who traveled around Russia, who opened campaign offices and recruited volunteers, and that was opposition Alexei Navalny. But of course, he was barred from running, and now he's calling for a boycott.
Right. He's telling his supporters not to bother voting at all. Register your protest that way. I want to ask you, because I know you've been traveling all over these last few weeks trying to take the pulse of this huge nation. I know you've been in Vladivostok near North Korea. You've also been in some small towns south of Moscow. I'm sure it's impossible to generalize about a country this big, same as it would be in the States. But are you hearing any common threads as you report?
I guess the one thing I've really noticed everywhere I've been is that people are more apolitical than they are actively supporting Putin. And I think there's a reason for that. Russians don't really have an experience that their voice has made any difference in the past, and largely they're right. There's really this feeling that, okay, things are far from perfect, but they could be a lot worse. When I was in Tula in central Russia earlier this week, I spoke to one teacher. Her name is Sofia Castillo. She's 28 years old. Here's what she had to say.
It's okay now. So I think I'm not going to change anything. Putin is my choice. Well, yes. And the same thing I can say about those people who surround me. They had the same opinion.
It's so interesting to hear her say, look, things are okay. I think I'm not going to change anything. Is that the key to Putin's longevity? 18 years and counting now in office. He represents stability.
Yes, absolutely. I really think Putin is the status quo candidate. And just for context, I think it's important to remember that Russia has had a lot of shocks over the past century, revolutions and wars and communism and really far too much hardship. People prefer the status quo that they know, even if they're unhappy with it, to some kind of radical changes and a future they can't predict. And I really think that's the secret to Putin's success.
A success he's hoping to extend for another 6 years if he prevails on Sunday. Thanks so much, Lucien.
Thank you.
And that's NPR's Lucien Kim in Yekaterinburg, which is about 1,000 miles east of Moscow.
Mary Louise, I don't need to tell you that Russia has been big news here in the U.S. this week, but not because of the presidential elections.
So can I tell you it's the same thing here in my hotel gym this morning? Yeah, I was on the treadmill. They've got the whole wall of TVs up there, all tuned to various Russian stations, and they weren't leading with the Russian election either. There was a lot of coverage of the poisoned spy, Sergei Skripal, and coverage, of course, of these new sanctions that the Trump administration has now imposed on 19 Russian individuals and 5 organizations.
Yeah, the announcement of those sanctions gives you a sense of how broad Russian cyber attacks were. Russian hackers have apparently targeted critical American systems, including power grids, for years, on and off since at least 2011, according to the cybersecurity company Symantec. Bill Wright is Symantec's Director of Government Affairs, and I asked him how deeply the hackers have penetrated these power grids.
Well, it's a little bit hard to tell. We, of course, are limited by our customer base. That's what our sort of vision is. We did see some areas where the threat had entered into the operational realm.
That means they could flip the switch and turn off the power.
Of some energy sector. I think there's a little bit more complicated than that, but they certainly are able to stage and potentially create more difficult problems like sabotage.
Tell us about some of the ways the hackers gained access to these systems.
In some cases, they use some pretty mundane ways to get into the systems. One are very well-crafted spear phishing, so just your basic malicious email.
Click on this link, open this attachment,
exactly,
that sort of thing.
Exactly. Now, these are very well-crafted, and so they're highly customized to individuals.
Oh, like specific employees of a particular energy company?
Some of that, but also things that would interest someone working at an energy company. For instance, one of the first malicious emails that we identified in this second campaign was an invitation to a New Year's party that was sort of focused on energy sector interests. We thought that was very good. It was actually very effective.
The federal government says these hackers were Russian and that this was backed by the Russian state. Is that consistent with what you've seen?
So we have no reason to doubt attribution coming from the United States government in this case.
What are the signs that a hacking campaign like this is being organized by a high-level, well-funded, government-backed campaign as opposed to just some malicious hackers using their spare time?
You know, we look at a couple things. First off, in this case, highly sophisticated group. They are highly resourced. They are highly persistent. So they're not moving around looking for targets. They will hang on a target until they get in.
So you know that for 6 years or more, these same hackers have been trying to get into these same energy companies.
That's right. So they've managed to go underground for a little while, retool, come up with some new and interesting ways, and then came back again in 2016 or 2015. Also, we look at the targeting. You know, what is it that they are interested in? Are they interested in profit motive? Doesn't appear so in this case. So a lot of times we can tell whether there is a state-sponsored element to the attacks.
Why would one country target another country's energy sector?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, I think the energy sector in particular is probably the most critical of critical infrastructure. Let's just take the power grid. If the power grid goes down, there's cascading effects. It doesn't just affect the power here at NPR. This affects every sector from financial to water to nuclear right across the board. Everything that depends on electricity would be affected. So certainly is a node of interest for a state-sponsored group.
It's been reported that Russia has turned off the power in another country before. They did this in Ukraine. What would happen if Russia did this in the U.S.?
Well, if what happened in Ukraine 2015, 2016, and we had mass power outages, there would certainly be a citizen safety aspect to this. It would also have cascading effects to every financial sector, to the way we do water, to the way we do our lives every day. It would be a very devastating blow.
Bill Wright is Director of Government Affairs and Senior Policy Counsel for Symantec. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you, Ari.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. He's been called a reformer. He's been called a bully. Next week, he visits the U.S. Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is coming to drum up business for the Saudi kingdom. Back home, some are accusing him of coercing wealthy Saudis for cash. But he's also making reforms, like letting women drive. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
You can expect a large entourage and a splashy PR campaign to accompany Prince Mohammed bin Salman on his first visit to the U.S. since he was named Crown Prince last June. The 32-year-old Saudi royal is expected to meet with President Trump Tuesday and is likely to be pressed on his plans for the protracted Saudi-led war in Yemen. But then the rest of his trip will be about investments.
I think he wants to convey the message that Saudi Arabia is open for business.
Halima Croft is with RBC Capital Markets. She says Prince Mohammed has been shaking up the status quo as he tries to implement broad economic reforms in the ultra-conservative kingdom.
We think of him sort of moving fast and breaking things. He's young, he's disruptive.
The crown prince has quickly consolidated power, ousting royal rivals and locking up opposition along the way. But he's also liberalizing the kingdom, allowing Saudis to attend concerts and movies, and allowing women to start their own businesses. This is part of his strategy to wean the country off its dependency on oil and make it welcoming to foreign investment, something the crown prince and his entourage will drive home during the visit.
What they want to say is, we are continuing with the important reforms. We want investment. We need foreign investment in our domestic industries to help generate jobs in Saudi Arabia.
But the crown prince will also have to calm some investors' nerves, rattled by a recent anti-corruption campaign in Saudi Arabia. Hundreds of princes, government ministers, and businessmen were rounded up and detained for 3 months at the luxurious Ritz-Carlton Hotel. There are reports some of the detainees were abused. The government says it collected more than $100 billion in what it calls settlements. Emily Hawthorne with Stratfor, a global intelligence company, says potential investors are right to be concerned the same thing won't happen to them.
They're going to be looking for any sort of signal of, can I trust this guy? Can I trust that my money is going to actually go into what I think it's going to go into? And so far, he hasn't supplied those answers.
Still, Hawthorne thinks the crown prince will find some investors tantalized by new business in Saudi Arabia. He'll visit Silicon Valley to push for technology deals. He'll head to Houston and New York to talk about the plan to sell off 5% of the state-owned Saudi Aramco, the world's largest oil company. The Saudis are hoping to raise $100 billion in the Aramco deal to be used for infrastructure projects and the like.
One of the challenges for a company like this in putting itself out there for its public is that people will start to ask more questions.
Patrick Heller is with the Natural Resource Governance Institute, which focuses on governance of state-owned companies. He says Aramco has a very poor track record for things like transparency. Once listed, it'll have to divulge the size of its oil reserves and how much of the profits go back to the royal family.
I have little doubt that Saudi Aramco has very sophisticated financial management, but the fact of the matter is that from the outside, we don't really know exactly what those financial management systems look like.
The New York Stock Exchange is in the running to be part of the Aramco deal, which is on track to become the largest public offering ever, a strong selling point for Saudi Arabia's crown prince during his U.S. tour. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Welch & Forbes, customized investment portfolios, private trustees, and family office services since 1838. WelchForbes.com.
WBUR's Artery is proud media sponsor of the 11th annual Salem Film Fest, March 22nd through the 29th. It's New England's largest documentary film festival featuring the best work from around the world. Find details at wbur.org/events. It's 11 before 5.
WBUR supporters include Direct Tire and Auto Service. Barry Steinberg and his team thank clients for 43 years of business. Tires, brakes, and complete auto repair at directtire.com. And Brookline Bank's Signature Business Banking. Comprehensive banking services for businesses and their owners. Learn more about Signature Business Banking at brooklinebank.com.
New book by Daniel Mallory Ortberg puts a feminist twist on old fairy tales. The author has also recently transitioned.
I was not sure that I was going to come out in time for the book tour, and one of the things that I was really anxious about was the thought of people saying, hey, a lot of shifting gender roles in your book. What's going on there? And having to say something like, oh, no reason?
That in the news in a busy week, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 8 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. NPR's podcast Invisibilia is back with its fourth season. And today they have the story of a reality show in the Horn of Africa that set out to change a culture. It led NPR's Elise Spiegel to ask, can telling a certain kind of story create a new reality?
Once upon a time, there was music on the radio, but then the music started fading out. First one radio station, then another, until there was almost no music to hear, and people started MacGyvering workarounds. One of the people who came up with a workaround was Hawa Abdi Hassan, a young woman who lived in a village outside Mogadishu, Somalia.
We used to use a memory card, fill the memory card with music, and listen to it from our phones.
In her home, as she cooked and cleaned, Hawa would sing along with the great Somali singers. But even in this private space, Hawa says she was careful.
I used to turn the volume low so nobody hears it.
Quietly?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The problem was Al-Shabaab, the Islamic extremist group that dominated large parts of the country. They didn't like music. In 2009, they banned music at weddings, banished musical ringtones. Then at some point, I guess they figured best to go straight to the source. So extremists started targeting the musicians themselves. The soloist Aden Hassan Salat was shot and killed in a tea shop. Others were murdered in the street. But through all of that, Hawa kept listening and practicing because Hawa had a dream.
I just wanted to sing and become an entertainer.
For most of her life, though, because of Al-Shabaab, that was a pretty far-fetched dream. But then in 2013, an unexpected and interesting opportunity emerged. Apparently, there was going to be a new reality television show, an American Idol-style reality show. Hawa says she instantly knew she wanted to join, even though she had to admit the idea really worried her. Can she explain what was she worried and afraid of?
Death.
What Hawa didn't know, couldn't know, is that this reality show, it was part of a much larger political plan.
Yes, sort of inoculation, you know, against the temptations of Al-Shabaab's austerity.
This is Ben Parker, who was director of communications for the UN in Mogadishu at the time. It was the UN that was behind the show. They provided the support and money. See, in 2013, though Al-Shabaab had finally been pushed out of Mogadishu, the situation in Somalia was far from stable. There were still regular attacks, so the new government, which had UN backing, needed to prove to Somalis that Shabaab's power really was fading, which is why a musical reality show that challenged the power of the music-hating group was so appealing.
The beauty of the reality show is that the form itself achieves some of your goals.
After all, not only was there music, there was democratic voting, individual expression. So even in its form, it communicated to its audience a very different kind of being. So, can a reality show actually change reality?
I'm very interested in how we make the normal.
How do people come to see the world around them as normal? An unremarkable fact, the way things are and should be. Betsy Levy-Pollack is a psychologist at Princeton University who studies media and how societies change. And she says that for a long time, people assumed that the path to political change depended on crafting the right argument.
It was all rhetoric and no poetic.
But starting in the 90s, Betsy says, poetics started gaining ground because psychologists realized that people consumed stories in this qualitatively different way.
Their defensiveness is disabled. Their counter-arguing is at rest.
What Betsy wanted to understand was whether this difference in how we consumed stories translated into any changes in what we thought and how we behaved. So she hooked up with this organization that was in the process of creating a new radio soap opera in Rwanda, a Romeo and Juliet-style romance between a boy and a girl from warring ethnicities. The point of the program was to encourage tolerance between ethnicities. And what Betsy found after a year of studying communities randomly assigned to listen,
what it boiled down to was that despite the fact that people loved this program, it didn't change their beliefs, but it did change their perceptions of norms. And at the same time, it changed their behavior.
It didn't change their beliefs. It changed their behaviors by changing what they considered to be the social norm. For example, people who listened to the program were way more cooperative when dividing up valuable resources, even when they had to divide those resources across ethnic lines. It absolutely moved the needle, which is a sobering idea.
We like to think that all of our behaviors flow from our convictions, and what we do is a reflection of who we are and what we think. But we're constantly tuning ourselves to fit in with the social world around us.
So what this work suggests is that if you change someone's perception of what constitutes the social norm, like you convince people that the world is safe enough to sing in public, even though in actual fact, singing in public is incredibly dangerous, then you just might be able to move the needle on the ground. Which brings us back to Hawo, the young woman who quietly listened to music off a memory card and dreamed of being a singer. She says when she first took to the stage to compete in the show, which was called Inspire Somalia, her hands were shaking.
Yeah, that was my first time. Before that, I did not sing in public places.
After Hawo, two other contestants had their turn, both men. One had a famous musician father. The second, Mustafa, had composed his own song. When they finished came the part of the show that was supposed to serve as a democracy demonstration. Ballots were distributed to the audience and judges. And for a minute, the room was quiet as they marked the papers in their laps.
Mustafa
ended up winning. But Hawa says she was honestly not upset. For her, just the act of singing in public for the first time was enough.
I was very happy. I was happy as like I was born that day.
Somalia continues to struggle with attacks by Shabab, but there's at least one undeniable change since 2013. Music is back in the streets, brought back slowly and painfully through a combination of political strategy and personal courage. Elise Spiegel, NPR News.
NPR's Invisibilia has a new episode out today. You can listen on your local public radio station or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the University of Florida, committed to moving the world forward. Powered by its land-grant heritage, from renewable energy to global health, UF researchers, students, and peers are working together for the greater good. GatorGood.com. Constant Contact, featuring email marketing tools to help small businesses connect with their existing customers, and list growth tools for collecting new contacts. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And from Dartmouth, offering Master of Healthcare Delivery Science, an online program for physicians and healthcare executives teaching business, leadership, and health policy to transform healthcare at healthcaredelivery.dartmouth.edu.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Skies should clear up tonight. Temperatures should head downward to the mid-20s. Tomorrow, generous on the clouds. Sun showing up from time to time. Highs only in the mid-30s. Sunday should be the sunnier of the weekend days. Still chilly, though, in the mid-30s. Same thing for Monday. Mainly sunny. Cloudy on Tuesday with a chance of snow Tuesday night. 37 degrees now in the Boston area at 1 before 5.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Salem 5 Insurance Services. Insurance know-how for the business you're building. Salem5.com/insurance. Let's uncomplicate your coverage.
From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Russian President Vladimir Putin is expected to win this weekend's election in a landslide, but not everybody supports him.
I'm voting for Grigory Yavlinsky because I think he's smart. I trust him.
A vote in Russia that the world is watching, even if the result may be no surprise. It's Friday, March 16th, and this is All Things Considered. I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead, a look back 50 years at the My Lai massacre, when American soldiers in Vietnam killed more than 500 civilians in a few hours.
Man, woman, children, and the whole bit, everything that could aid the VC, you know, every living thing, that was sort of like the order.
Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton sees this week's Democratic victory of a former Marine in Pennsylvania as a sign of things to come in Washington.
I think you see the generation of veterans who went to Iraq and Afghanistan taking over for the generation that sent us there.
It's now 1 past 5.
Live from the NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Even as authorities in South Florida tried to determine what caused a newly installed pedestrian bridge to come down on a highway yesterday, killing at least 6 people, they say they believe no one is alive beneath tons of concrete and twisted metal now. Juan Perez is director of the Miami-Dade Police Department.
Late last night, it was approximately 10 o'clock, when the determination was made that this no longer was going to be a search and rescue mission, and now it is a recovery and investigatory mission.
State and federal investigators say it appears cables suspending the bridge were being tightened after a stress test when the 950-ton span collapsed. Scheduled to open next year, the bridge was built to link Florida International University with the nearby town of Sweetwater. At least one student was among the victims. The $14.2 million bridge was designed to make it safer for students to cross the busy highway. British police say they're investigating the recent death of a Russian businessman in London as murder. NPR's Joanna Kakissos reports from London. The investigation comes as British-Russian relations have soured following the suspicious poisoning of an ex-Russian spy and his daughter.
Police say Nikolai Glushkov was strangled to death. His family found his body in his London home late on March 12th. His death does not appear to be related to the nerve gas poisoning of Sergei and Yulia Skripal. Glushkov used to be an executive at Aeroflot, the Russian state airline, until he was jailed in 1999 for fraud and money laundering. He fled to Britain after his release. He was close to a critic of Vladimir Putin, exiled oligarch Boris Berezovsky, who was found hanged in his London home in 2013. Meanwhile, Russia is opening its own investigations into Glushkov's death and the poisoning of Yulia Skripal. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, London.
Goldman Sachs is out with data on its gender pay gap in its British operations. It shows men make as much as 72% more in bonuses and about 55% in pay than women. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports the bank says it's largely because women are underrepresented in the executive ranks.
Goldman Sachs says its own data shows how far the company has yet to go to achieve more gender parity. The company says while it sets pay the same way for everyone, its large pay gap reflects the fact that few women are in its executive ranks. The bank has two divisions based in Britain, and the data show a sizable gender pay gap in both, ranging from 16% to 72%, depending on the calculation. In the UK, large companies are required to report pay data broken out by gender. A similar reporting requirement was set to take effect in the U.S., but was suspended by the Trump administration last year. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Output from the nation's mines and factories was up in February, rising 1.1%. On Wall Street, the Dow closed up 72 points today. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Massachusetts House Speaker Robert DeLeo is defending the chamber's use of non-disclosure agreements. He says the agreements are part of doing business. Yesterday, Methuen state representative told her colleagues that she was pressured into signing a non-disclosure agreement 7 years ago when she was fired from her job as a legislative aide. She says she was the subject of harassment in the form of false rumors about a relationship with a lawmaker. DeLeo says he was unaware of any allegation of harassment at the time. Speaking in Manchester, New Hampshire today, Arizona Republican U.S. Senator Jeff Flake says he's considering a run for president in 2020. Flake is a frequent critic and a target of President Trump. He says the Republican Party needs a better leader.
It has not been in my plans to run for president, but I've not ruled it out. I hope that someone does run in the Republican primary, somebody to challenge the president.
Flake is retiring from the Senate at the end of this year. A bridge over the Mass Turnpike in Charlton was dedicated today in honor of a state trooper who was killed 2 years ago after his cruiser was rear-ended on the highway. At the time, Trooper Thomas Clardy was parked on the side of the highway conducting a traffic stop. At today's ceremony, Governor Charlie Baker called the trooper a powerful example of selflessness.
All of us would hope that we could live up to the wonderful example of service and commitment to his country, to his Commonwealth, to his community, and to his family that he represents.
Investigators say the driver who hit Clardy's cruiser was high on drugs at the time, had swerved across all three travel lanes before he hit the cruiser. The driver pleaded not guilty and is set to go on trial next month. For the first time in a decade, L.L. Bean is not giving worker bonuses. The struggling outdoor retailer in Maine says it will also eliminate 100 jobs early next month. 500 workers have already taken voluntary early retirement. L.L. Bean said today its annual revenue for the past year was nearly flat. Celtics visit to the Orlando Magic tonight. Bruins play Tampa Bay tomorrow. And in the forecast, clear skies overnight tonight, down around the 20s. Tomorrow, more clouds than sunshine, right around the mid-30s. Sunday, heavier on the sunshine, back in the mid-30s. 37 degrees right now at 6 past 5.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by College Vine. Mentors selected from Brown, Michigan, MIT, and more help with college lists and the application process. Learn more at collegevine.com. And Penguin Young Readers, publisher of She Persisted Around the World, 13 Women Who Changed History, including profiles of Malala, J.K. Rowling, and Wangari Maathai, written by Chelsea Clinton.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Moscow, where the polls are set to open at 8 sharp Sunday morning. Russia is holding a presidential election, or coronation, as some here call it. Vladimir Putin is running for president again. Here's the challenge for the Putin campaign. Even Putin seems a little bored by it. His final campaign speech this week lasted a whopping 2 minutes. He never actually mentioned the election.
Добрый день, дорогие друзья. Мне очень приятно в этот день быть вместе с вами.
Cheers there from a crowd in Sevastopol, in Crimea, home to Russia's Black Sea Fleet. This morning, the Kremlin followed up with a new video. In it, Putin makes a direct appeal to Russians, please come out to vote.
Воспользуйтесь своим правом выбрать будущее для великой любимой нами России.
The good news for Putin is that the seven candidates challenging him for the presidency are all polling in single digits, which means Putin, who's been in power either as president or prime minister for 18 years, is likely to stay in power.
So Russia, a country of more than 140 million people, 11 time zones, impossible to capture what everybody who's going to turn out and vote on Sunday might be thinking about this, but we've picked three voices who'll give a little sampling of the range of views in this vast country. And we're about to pay a call on one of them. We're just headed up to her apartment.
Hi, buddy.
Actually, the first creature to greet us is Yonya, Victoria Ivleva's dog. Ivleva is 62 years old. She'll vote on Sunday for one of the opposition candidates, Grigory Yavlinsky.
I'm voting for Grigory Yavlinsky.
Yavlinsky, why?
Because I think he's smart, he's kind, and I think it's very important for a ruler to be kind. I trust him.
What do you say to people who say, why bother to vote on Sunday? This election is rigged. We already know the outcome. There's no point.
Oh, I think there's always a point to struggle. I don't think we're in a sort of Buddha position to sit and watch. lots of people have been sitting and watching for so many years with no result. And I think it's probably the last chance to do something and to say something. Because if Vladimir Putin is going to be at power for the next 6 years, and I'm afraid he's going to be at power, we don't know what will be his next step, but I'm afraid he is his own prisoner, and the prisoner of his own mind and of his own actions. There's no way for him to change or to start any democratic changes.
Do you think the vote on Sunday is rigged? Is there any chance that somebody besides Putin will win?
I don't think so, but the elections are not decided because you have to go and vote.
But explain to me what you hope to achieve by going and voting for a different candidate, for Yavlinsky, on Sunday.
First of all, I would do what I think I should do, and I would stay a truthful person. And when in future, many years from now, my great-grandchildren would ask me, what did you do living in those times? I would say I voted for a person whom I trusted and who I think could help Russia to get out of this turmoil.
The argument that one of the opposition leaders who's not being allowed to run, Alexei Navalny, makes is don't vote. That's the best way to oppose the system, is don't participate in it.
I would agree if you know that the result would be 90% of boycotters.
You mean if everybody listened and just didn't come out and vote?
Boycott is great when it is a true boycott. When it's just 10% of population or 3% of population, who would care? No one would care. The other thing is, I think it's in most situations in life, it's better to do something than not to do anything. You never know living in Russia. You know, it's a country without floor and without ceiling.
What does that mean?
It's a country where everything is allowed and at the same time nothing is allowed. And you figure out somehow.
Victoria Ivleva hopes to live to see another president of Russia. Our next voter is not so eager for change. We meet Makar Vikhlyantsev at his office, a Brooklyn-style loft that shares an alley with an old bread factory. Vikhlyantsev is 33. He helps run Project Network, a pro-Putin youth group. I start with a question I'm pretty sure we know the answer to.
Who will you vote for?
For Putin.
Why?
I have lived with Putin in power for a long time, but I also remember life under Yeltsin and life under Gorbachev, who was worse than Yeltsin. And what I remember from those times were long lines in stores and food stamps to purchase food. I was ashamed of my country. I was ashamed of my president. When Putin came to power, my shame vanished. I gained a sense of pride. It was so cool.
You're saying Putin has made you proud to be a Russian.
Yeah.
What about your actual daily life? Is it good under Putin? Is it getting better every year?
Yeah, it's getting better.
How?
Here's an example from my own life. I bought my first car for $300. The neighborhood I used to live in, it was a very large apartment building on the outskirts. I was only the third person to own a car in that entire apartment building. Today, we are running out of space for people to park. Life has improved for people. Now they can afford to purchase cars. They can get loans. I can see this with my own eyes.
To someone coming in who's not Russian, everyone seems to know who will win. There's no suspense. His main opponent is not being allowed to run. President Putin controls the media. Is it a real election? And does it matter to you if it's a real election?
I do think this is a real election. When it comes to mass media control, as you can see, there is no KGB agent sitting outside, making sure I don't say something out of line. I can surf the internet without restrictions. I can open any web page. There is even a whole radio station that broadcasts anti-Putin programming around the clock.
If
other candidates struggle to attract voters, whose problem is this? They have budgets, they have teams. If they are not capable, should this be Putin's problem? Why should he be asked to help them? I don't get it.
You're saying Putin will win on Sunday because he's the best candidate.
yeah. not because there's something wrong with the system.
Yeah.
Right. Do you find him, is he exciting as a leader? Is he inspiring?
Мы должны вернуться назад, 2000 год, когда он пришел.
To give you context, we have to go back to the year 2000, when he first came to power. I remember Russia at that time. There was a war in the Caucasus. In Tatarstan, they introduced their own passports. Yakutia adopted its own constitution. Rich people talked about packing their bags and leaving. And here comes Putin. He pulled Russia out of the swamp. He heard our voices. Something started to change.
We went a few rounds on the question of what he thinks of Putin as a person, as a man. Then Vihilyantsev said the last thing on earth I expected him to say.
Телесериал «Sex and the City».
Do you know? Sex and the City, I do.
И в этом телесериале там показывают, я смотрел.
In Sex and the City, they present typical situations that women find themselves in. And it can be used as a kind of girl's guide to behavior. Something very similar happens with Putin. When you watch him on TV, you see an example of how you should conduct yourself in life. I grew up without a father. When I was a senior in high school, I had no idea of how to behave in this or that situation, but I would observe the way Putin responds, the way he addresses challenging questions. I found this very informative.
And now, finally, we're headed to the office of Vyacheslav Moskvitchov. He's made his decision about the election on Sunday, and it is to not make a decision. He's not planning to vote for any candidate on Sunday. That's a popular choice here in Moscow. So let's head up and meet him. Moskvitchov greets us in the office where he sees patients. He's a psychotherapist. He works with families and couples, and he loves this work. He feels he can make a real difference in people's lives. In other words, he has a life outside politics. So do a lot of other Russians, he says. Moskvitchov describes it this way.
A parallel reality.
A parallel reality.
It seems to me that it's another state. And we can take part in that state.
Who's running the Kremlin is not so relevant to your life.
And I think that it's state more bigger. Half of our population, or maybe more, don't play in that... And the spectacle.
The spectacle that is Russian politics. Moskvitchov says reality is talking to your neighbors. It's talking to people who sit down across from you on the train. Then he switches to Russian to make one final point, that this election is theater. It's a play.
Putin has the lead role. He's the main character. He did not participate in the debates because only supporting actors do the debates. The way I see it, my only option is to not be part of this play.
Who's the director if Putin is the star? That's the question.
Interesting. I think it's a good metaphor. I think I'm sure that we have some directors too.
Vyacheslav Moskvitchov, on who's really pulling the strings. We also heard from Makar Vihilyantsev and Victoria Ivleva. Three Russians, three views on who to vote for, whether to vote at all, how to make their voices heard in today's Russia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by North Shore Medical Center, where orthopedic surgeons get you moving again with advanced treatment options like hip and knee replacements and other procedures. Learn more at nsmc.partners.org. And Brilliant Earth, conflict-free diamond engagement rings, wedding rings, and vintage fine jewelry, online at brilliantearth.com and their Newbury Street showroom. Appointments available now.
This is 90.9 WBUR. U.S. stocks ended up gaining ground for the day today. The Dow finished up 0.29%, about 73 points, to close at 24,947. S&P picked up 0.17% to close at 2752, and the NASDAQ ended up right where it began. It was flat at 74.82. Details on Marketplace in just over an hour. It's now 19 past 5.
Funding for WBUR's Business Report comes from Comcast Business, providing internet service for businesses that depend on it. Information at comcastbusiness.com. Comcast Business, internet, voice, and TV built for business.
Here's the weekend forecast now with meteorologist Dave Goldbaum.
Tonight, becoming mostly clear. It'll be cold with lows in the middle 20s by morning. Saturday, still lots of clouds around, some partial sunshine at times, high 34. Sunny and chilly Sunday, high again 34.
37 degrees now in the Boston area. From the WBUR iLab, check out The Artery, Boston's online arts destination. Today, the Tony Award-winning play The Humans is at the Schubert Theater in Boston. Critic Jeremy Goodwin says it takes a hard look at our age of economic anxiety. That's at The Artery at WBUR.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform with over 18 million monthly users designed to connect people from anywhere in the world on any device. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And Farmers Insurance, committed to helping people understand the ins and outs of insurance so they can prepare for life's ups and downs. Coverage options and more information can be found at Farmers.com.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The White House is trying to tamp down speculation that another staff shakeup is in the works. In a week that saw Secretary of State Rex Tillerson fired by tweet, there is renewed speculation that National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster or other members of the cabinet may be on their way out. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins me now from the White House. Hi, Tam.
Hey, Ari.
Let's start with McMaster. What is the latest on his status?
So NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman reports that McMaster will likely leave, although there is no timetable on when that might happen. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders last night tweeted out that she had spoken with the president when a story emerged in The Washington Post saying that Trump had decided that he was going to remove McMaster. And Trump told her that that was not accurate, that he has no intention of making a change there at this time, and that the two of them have a great working relationship. Now, randomly, there have been a lot of H.R. McMaster sightings around the White House today, which doesn't always happen. A bunch of us reporters were walking through the West Wing in areas where we're allowed to walk. And what do you know? There was H.R. McMaster standing there sort of near the Oval Office.
Right.
And then an ABC News correspondent tweeted that she caught up with him outside of the West Wing. And she said that he told her that Sarah Sanders had set things straight. And then he added, everybody has got to leave the White House at some point. Then she says she asked whether he was leaving sooner rather than later, and he said, I'm doing my job, and walked away.
You know, people are sometimes criticized for focusing on palace intrigue, and yes, there has been a lot of turnover at this White House, but Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster are two vital positions, and a change in both or either of them means a big change in the way American policy is determined and executed.
Right. And just think about the timing on this. This is right after President Trump has accepted this offer to meet with the North Korean dictator, though there isn't a lot of clarity on where and when exactly that will happen. You know, the National Security Advisor position is a very important position in terms of sort of figuring out how the dialogue works within the White House and externally, and sort of managing the White House foreign policy.
When you have a White House with this much turnover and speculation about future turnover, how does that affect people doing their everyday jobs? I mean, how does it affect morale?
Well, can you imagine if this was happening in our office every day?
No.
It would be terrible. You know, Sarah Sanders said that today, Chief of Staff John Kelly actually sat down a bunch of senior staffers this morning and told them that, you know, tried to reassure them. Here's how she described that conversation.
Reassuring them that there were no immediate personnel changes at this time, and that people shouldn't be concerned. We should do exactly what we do every day, and that's come to work and do the very best job that we can.
No immediate personnel changes at this time is neither reassuring nor particularly conclusive, especially when you have the president himself saying just this week, there will always be change, and I think you want to see change.
There has been controversy surrounding several other cabinet secretaries recently and speculation that any of them might be replaced. Can you run through who they are and what the White House is saying about them?
We don't have time for me to go through all of them.
Because it's such a long list.
It is a very long list, and people sort of rotate on and off. But Sarah Sanders today was specifically asked about VA Secretary Shulkin, who was on the receiving end of a very critical Inspector General's report. Also, HUD Secretary Ben Carson, who is still trying to get his story straight about a $31,000 dining room set that was ordered for his office. That order has been canceled. She was asked whether the president offered the same assurances to them that he offered to H.R. McMaster, and she simply repeated, we don't have any personnel changes at this time.
NPR's Tamara Keith at the White House. Thanks, Tam.
You're welcome.
There's a new report out today on abortion safety and quality in the United States. It comes from the National Academy of Sciences, and it is the first time in more than 40 years the group has taken an in-depth look at the science. It finds high levels of safety for surgical and medical abortions. As NPR's Allison Kojak reports, it concludes that many regulations states have imposed on abortion don't improve safety, but instead create barriers to access and quality.
The researchers look at the four major methods used for abortions in the U.S., from the time before women get the procedure through their follow-up care. Ned Kalange is the co-chair of the committee that wrote the study.
I would say the main takeaway is that abortions that are provided in the United States are safe and effective.
Kalange is a family practitioner and professor of medicine at the University of Colorado in Denver. He says the study shows most abortions, about 90%, happen in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. And he says complications are extremely rare. One of the biggest barriers to safe abortions, he says, are state laws and regulations that have no basis in medical research.
There are some requirements that require clinicians to misinform women of the health risks that say you have to inform a woman that an abortion will increase her risk of breast cancer.
That rule exists in five states.
There are policies that mandate clinically unnecessary services like pre-abortion ultrasounds, separate inpatient counseling. There are required waiting periods.
27 states make women wait at least 24 hours for an abortion, and 11 require women to have an ultrasound before they can terminate their pregnancy, according to the Guttmacher Institute, which does research on reproductive health. There are state laws that dictate who can perform abortions and where they can do them, and some require all abortions to happen in the equivalent of a hospital or surgery center. Others require a doctor to have admitting privileges in a nearby hospital.
Those sorts of laws have been totally debunked.
That's Hal Lawrence, the CEO of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. He says the National Academy's report shows that most of those laws do nothing to improve women's health, and many of them just end up delaying when women get an abortion.
Abortion is safer when it's performed earlier in gestation. And so delaying and making people wait and go through hoops of unnecessary extra second procedures does not improve the safety, and actually by having them delay can actually worsen the safety.
The Supreme Court in 2016 voided some state abortion laws when it ruled that Texas's strict rules around abortion facilities impose an undue burden on women. But other laws remain in place, even without any backing in medical research. Donna Harrison is the executive director of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists. She says abortion should be treated like other surgical procedures, with lots of oversight and regulation.
The tendency to look at abortion as though it were not a serious medical procedure is irresponsible. We all know that the fetus is killed during an abortion, but women can be harmed by irresponsible medical care.
The new report, which runs more than 200 pages, addresses most aspects of abortion care. Additional takeaways? Nurse practitioners and physician's assistants can perform abortions just as safely as doctors. And women who get abortions show no negative long-term impact on their physical or mental health. Allison Kojak, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR, and the forecast clear and breezy overnight tonight. Cold, too, down in the 20s by morning. Weekend highs should peak in the mid-30s only. Lots of gray around tomorrow, some shots of sun. Sunday should be the brighter day. More sunshine, fewer clouds. Sunny skies on Monday, clouds on Tuesday, the chance of snow Tuesday night. 37 degrees now in Boston at 5:30.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brown University's pre-college summer programs. Prepare for college success with 300 courses on campus, online, and abroad. brown.edu/summer. The Handel & Haydn Society, presenting the Bach Mass in B minor, an inspiring and monumental celebration March 23rd and 25th at Symphony Hall, handelandhaydn.org. And the ICA, with art in the age of the Internet, from video to virtual reality, see how the Internet has transformed art. Now on view, ICABoston.org.
I'm Bill Littlefield. In 1993, Chris Street set a free throw record at the University of Iowa. 3 days later, he died.
You know, as a parent who's lost a child, you don't want people to forget him. And I guess with that record, it was just another thing to remind people not to forget him.
But last month, Street's record faced a serious threat. That story is coming up this week on Only a Game. Join us tomorrow at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. here on WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Russian officials are outraged over comments from British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson in connection with the poisoning of a former Russian spy and his daughter by a nerve agent. Larry Miller reports Johnson is blaming Russia's president for the poisoning.
Speaking to the British news media, Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson says Britain has nothing against the Russian people, but he insists the quarrel over the use of a military-grade nerve agent in England is with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
And we think it overwhelmingly likely that it was his decision to direct the use of a nerve agent on the streets of the UK, on the streets of Europe, for the first time since the Second World War.
A Kremlin spokesman describes Johnson's accusation as a shocking and unforgivable breach of diplomatic rules and decent behavior. Russia denies any involvement in the nerve agent attack. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Speaking today in the battleground state of New Hampshire, one of President Trump's most vocal Republican critics told the crowd someone needs to challenge Trump for the GOP nomination in 2020. Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona says the party needs to be reminded of what it means to be a traditional, decent Republican. He says politics have become too partisan and divisive.
We must turn away from this brand of poisonous politics, the kind of poison that has the president slinging insults like a bad comic at a cheap roast. Yes, the pendulum swings, thank goodness, and the people themselves will show us the way out of here.
Flake is retiring from the Senate at the end of this year and says it wasn't his plan to run for president, but he hasn't ruled it out. He also says he would consider running as an independent. A spokeswoman for the Republican Party National Committee dismissed Flake's potential challenge. Stocks finished modestly higher on Wall Street, led by banks, industrial companies, and retailers today. The Dow rose 72 points. You're listening to NPR News. Germany's new interior minister has declared that Islam does not belong to the country in announcing tougher immigration policies, but as Esme Nicholson reports, the comments are at odds with the views of German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
In his first major interview since being sworn in as interior minister, Horst Seehofer said, quote, Islam does not belong to Germany and that his country is shaped by Christianity. He added that while Muslims already here belong to Germany, Germans should not have to give up their Christian traditions and customs out of, quote, false consideration for others. Seehofer also announced plans to see quicker deportations of failed asylum seekers in what is seen as a bid to win back voters from the far-right AfD party. Merkel has quickly distanced herself from his remarks, emphasizing Friday that just as 4 million Muslims living in Germany belong, so does their religion. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
AT&T is squaring off against the federal government in an antitrust trial next week that could lay out what media companies will look like in the future. It could also shape how we get and pay for streaming TV and movies. AT&T says it needs to gobble up Time Warner to have a chance against the likes of Amazon, Netflix, and Google in the evolving world of video entertainment. But the government says consumers will end up paying more if the merger is allowed to go through. On Wall Street, The Nasdaq added a fraction of a point today. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Two Democratic lawmakers publicly accused Massachusetts House leadership yesterday of trying to silence former employees who had been harassed in the workplace by using non-disclosure agreements. Well, today the Speaker of the House is defending the branch's use of the agreements. More now from WBUR's Steve Brown at the State House.
Speaker Robert DeLeo says the House has never used a non-disclosure agreement, or NDA, relative to any sexual harassment cases. As to Representative Diana DeZoglio's claim that she felt she had no choice but to sign an NDA after she was terminated as a legislative aide 7 years ago, DeLeo said she entered into the agreement with the advice of her own attorney.
She seemed to be pleased in terms of the outcome when it occurred. So in terms of her being pressured, I've got no idea about that.
DeLeo says it's important for confidentiality to be available for the victims of workplace harassment, should they so choose to have that confidentiality. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Steve Brown at the State House.
A Boston judge has rejected a request to reduce a second-degree murder conviction of the man accused of killing 2-year-old Bella Bond. Lawyers from Michael McCarthy argued he should have been convicted of only manslaughter, and they alleged the girl's mother was the perpetrator. McCarthy is serving a life sentence for the 2015 killing of the little girl, whose remains washed ashore on Deer Island in Boston. Today, the judge ruled there was ample evidence for a murder conviction. A Salvadoran national has pleaded guilty to authorizing the murder of a 15-year-old boy in East Boston in 2015. 27-year-old Oscar Duran also pleaded guilty to racketeering. Prosecutors say that he was a national leader of the violent MS-13 gang. Federal prosecutors say the group, based in El Salvador, is responsible for 6 murders in this state between 2014 and 2016. People going to the St. Patrick's Day parade in South Boston Sunday are being asked to take public transportation. The company that runs the commuter rail says it will add extra cars to accommodate the crowds. The MBTA is warning that Red Line trains might not be able to stop at all at Broadway Station at certain times if it's overcrowded. Shuttle buses will run between South Station and the parade route. It's 5:36.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by America's biopharmaceutical companies, where researchers here in Massachusetts and across the country go boldly in search of breakthrough cures. More at goboldly.com. And Tufts University's Gordon Institute, re-engineering the MBA for tech professionals. Earn your master's in engineering management in as little as 2 years. Gordon.tufts.edu.
Tonight, the Celtics are likely to be without Kyrie Irving once again when they play Orlando. He's out with a sore knee for a second game. Al Horford is expected to be back on court tonight. And in the forecast, a cold night ahead, but a clear one as clouds move on out, down in the mid-20s by tomorrow morning. Some clouds return for tomorrow, although the sun should make a few cameos. Highs about 34 degrees. Sunday, fewer clouds, more sun, still stuck in the mid-30s, which is where it is right now. 37 degrees at 5:37.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. And Little Brown & Company, publisher of Obama, An Intimate Portrait by Pete Souza, Barack Obama's chief official White House photographer. This book of more than 300 photos is available now where books are sold.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. All this year, NPR is looking at the tumultuous events of 1968 that continue to shape our lives. 50 years ago today, in what is now known as the My Lai Massacre, American soldiers in Vietnam killed more than 500 civilians in 4 hours. It remains one of the darkest chapters in the history of the U.S. military. At the nation's service academies, that massacre is now part of the curriculum, which is where NPR's Quil Lawrence begins his report on My Lai 50 years later.
First of all, is discrimination. What is discrimination all about? Between civilians and other soldiers, or combatants and non-combatants?
It's like the soldiers have to decide between...
Major Logan Sisson is teaching a class on the laws of war to cadets at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. A lot of that boils down to basic questions. Whom must you protect, and whom can you shoot?
Like, what are legitimate targets and what's not?
What's a legitimate target, what is not? Because not just people.
He lays out scenarios for discussion, things these cadets might someday have to decide. One involves an enemy commander, a legitimate target for an airstrike.
Unfortunately, he will be traveling with an entourage, which includes 2 members of his operations staff, 5 bodyguards, 2 wives,
and 3 children.
Cadet Megan Guiney asks about the target's value.
What does he provide for the war effort again?
Cadet Bridger Barker says no.
Bridger, I'll probably go no because of due care, because we will kill his children and his wives, and they're non-combatants.
Cadet Lydia Knutson is leaning yes.
Yes, I mean, it's him and 7 other soldiers to 5 civilians, and he's, like, killing a lot of people, so, like, relatively speaking.
The talk is hypothetical. This class hasn't studied My Lai yet.
Was that where it was in Vietnam where we had some of our American soldiers killing civilians, and a couple of the officers told them, if you kept killing civilians, we're going to start killing you?
Not exactly. On March 16, 1968, Army Captain Ernest Medina told his soldiers that a string of hamlets, including My Lai, would be full of enemy troops and empty of civilians. When they landed, it turned out to be the opposite. But Charlie Company, encouraged by a young lieutenant named William Calley, spent 4 hours murdering civilians and burning their homes. Michael Bernhardt and Gary Garfolo were in Charlie Company that day.
You know, this is going to be a free-for-all. You can shoot anything you want, anything that moves.
Said, shoot everything. Man, woman, children, and the whole bit, everything that could aid the VC, you know, every living thing, that was sort of like the order. Some guys might have just flipped. There's people that are capable of doing that in those conditions.
What in effect he said was the village would be destroyed and all the people in it and so on.
These recordings come from the Oscar-winning documentary Interviews with My Lai Veterans. Bernardo Simpson is another soldier featured in that film.
Our captain, Medina, was telling us about we was going in and burn down and kill everything that was in the village. And now that we would leave nothing standing, that's women, children, babies, cows, cats, anything. And when we got off the chopper, we started shooting. And this lady got up and she ran and turned, had her back turned to me. And my platoon leader, Lieutenant LaCrosse, told me to shoot her. And I said, no, well, you shoot her. I don't want to shoot no lady, you know. So he said, well, I'm giving you a direct order to shoot. And if you don't shoot her, that you can be shot yourself. So as she'd been putting her foot in the door, I shot her about 5 or 6 times. And I went there and turned over, and there was a little 3-month-old baby.
Simpson said the baby was dead. Other soldiers say women were raped and mutilated. More than 200 children, many of them herded into a ditch and machine-gunned. Journalist Seymour Hersh broke the story in November of 1969. At first, the Army tried to cover it up. Now, the military teaches it at West Point, the Naval Academy at Annapolis, and here at the Air Force Academy.
That's a very bad example, but
it's a different class later in the day, and Major Sisson has now taken out a picture of himself standing next to 2 Vietnam veterans.
I got a peer picture of me with, on the my right is Hugh Thompson, and on the left is Larry Colburn. If we can use the term heroes, if there were any heroes at My Lai, it was them.
Hugh Thompson was a chopper pilot. He died in 2006, but here's an old interview he gave NPR.
So we then sat down. 2 guys, I think, was came over to the aircraft. Yeah, what do y'all want? You know, well, there's some civilians over in that ditch. You know, can you help them out? And they said, well, we can help them out of their misery. Oh, man, come on. Quit joking around. How about helping them out? Yeah, okay. And they walked away. And as we took off, we heard machine gun fire. You know, I said, my God, they're shooting into the ditch. And then that's when there was no use fooling ourselves anymore about what was going on.
Hugh Thompson landed his helicopter between American soldiers and civilians, and he said to Larry Colburn, his gunner, point your gun that way, and if they shoot any more civilians, shoot them.
Thompson and Larry Colburn and their crew chief, Glenn Andriotta, are heroes today, but it took 30 years for the Army to recognize that with the Soldier's Medal awarded in 1998. It was different 50 years ago. When Lieutenant William Calley went on trial, Hugh Thompson was shunned for testifying against him. Calley was the only one punished for the massacre, and public opinion supported him. There was even a song that made the top 40 in 1971.
My name is William Calley. I'm a soldier of this land. I've tried to do my duty and to gain the upper hand. But they've made me out a villain. They have stamped me with a brand. As we go,
that public support made it easy for President Richard Nixon to reduce Calley's sentence to house arrest. He served only 3.5 years. He's still alive and lives in Georgia. There was little accountability, and that's another lesson from My Lai which still resonates. John Sifton of Human Rights Watch researched war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. He points to the Haditha massacre in Iraq, 2005. U.S. Marines killed 24 civilians, including women and children, after a bomb attack on their unit.
In the end,
Only one person was held accountable, and it wasn't a very serious punishment.
Sifton says the military justice system usually gives senior officers a pass, and without real punishments, abuses will continue.
There were officers at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan where there were also serious abuses, including several deaths in custody. The officers who were involved got away with it, and they went on to Iraq where they committed abuses.
Haditha is not comparable to Milai, but the point is soldiers should still study it, says Ike Wilson, a former Army colonel.
I know through my whole 33 years of professional military service, both soldiering as well as a professor at West Point, Milai's been really a centerpiece with regard to the ethics of war.
Wilson served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He says Milai spurred changes like ending the draft. Volunteer officers are much better trained and educated. But he says the modern high-tech military isn't immune to the risk.
10,000 miles away, prosecuting warfare through the activities of armed drones, might that be the new face of potential Milais of our contemporary times in the future?
There's a museum in Milai now with a plaque listing all the names and the ages of the 504 people killed that day. American tourists, including Vietnam vets, regularly visit. And back at the Air Force Academy, Major Sisson is wrapping up his lesson.
Who are going to be our future heroes? I mean, hopefully we can prevent this in the future, but when we can't, who are going to be the heroes to stop it once it starts?
Cadet John Wendt has an answer of sorts.
Throughout history, militaries, no matter how good or how benevolent, have always slipped up at some point. And I think the reason why America's military is different is that America owned up and we said, we're going to fix this. We're going to try and be better than that. And I think that's why we're talking about it. You know, we're not pushing it underneath a rug.
And the class is dismissed. Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Colorado Springs.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It wasn't long ago that Tiger Woods was golf's greatest player and a global sports icon. His dramatic downfall is well known as a sex scandal and injuries knocked him off his pedestal, many thought, for good. But now Woods is in the midst of perhaps an equally dramatic comeback. From Orlando, Florida, NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
Tiger Woods has won the Arnold Palmer Invitational in Orlando 8 times, but yesterday's first round of the 2018 tournament may have been one of his most significant because it felt like a final round.
Give us that, Tiger!
The Tiger calls started with Woods' opening tee shot on a cold Orlando morning. The cheers built as the temperature and Woods heated up. His second birdie in as many holes put Woods at the top of the leaderboard for a while, a familiar position if you forget the last 5 years. It's been that long since he won a tournament. Not surprising, considering how his back finally betrayed him after years of violent, high-speed golf swings. His 5 years of wandering in the golf desert were marked by surgeries and abortive comebacks, and even embarrassing flubbed shots that had weekend golfers gleefully exclaiming, "Hey, I can do that." And then, April of last year, Woods had his fourth back surgery.
An anterior lumbar interbody fusion. Please explain to us what exactly that means.
The surgery, explained on the Golf Channel, worked so far. This golf season, Woods has been pain-free, and his results have followed. In the last couple of months, in this order, he's finished 23rd, 12th, and last week, 2nd, sending golf TV ratings to their highest level in 5 years. So, not surprising, the gallery following Woods in Orlando yesterday was kind of huge.
It's bananas up here, man. The crowds are 7-8 deep. Already, you know.
Charlie Avery from Atlanta was taking a break from the mob. He stood next to a fairway watching Woods from a distance. Avery has seen this scene before. He's come to this tournament at Bay Hill Golf Club for the past 16 years. What's different this time around, he says, is Woods.
I think now he have a better outlook on golf and life in general. You can tell by his aura. You know, he smiles more, you know, he's more in tune.
Woods would agree.
I feel like I am not really thinking as much around the golf course. I can just see it, feel it, and go. I've got my feels back again.
Woods' interactions with reporters, historically prickly, seem smoother as well. as long as you don't push too hard. After his round Thursday, he bristled when asked whether his recent success meant higher expectations.
The narrative has completely flipped from how you guys asked me questions. And I just want to just remind you guys that it wasn't that long ago that you were asking a different set of questions.
But in our defense, it has been a dramatic shift from wondering if Woods will ever play again, and even he doubted whether he could pull out of the injury tailspin, to can he win this week? While he was largely absent from the tour, a new crop of young golf stars emerged and thrived. Is there room now for Woods to rejoin them? Tour player Patrick Reed says, absolutely.
Just the electricity that goes around the entire place when he's playing well just seems kind of elevate, and hopefully I can continue playing some solid golf and see him late on Sunday.
Woods may not make it this Sunday. Halfway through the Bay Hill tournament, there's some distance between him and the leaders. But it hasn't killed the buzz. During his first round Thursday, Las Vegas oddsmakers made Woods the favorite to win next month's Masters. Seems crazy, but so did the idea that Tiger Woods would be playing and contending once again. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Orlando.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Applied Biomath, applying mechanistic, mathematical modeling, simulation, and analysis to accelerate and de-risk drug R&D. More at AppliedBiomath.com. And Legal Seafoods, visiting the docks daily in search of fresh seafood and testing it for purity in their lab. LegalSeafoods.com. If it isn't fresh, it isn't legal.
Join WBUR artery reporter Maria Garcia and social sculptor Julia Vogel on March 21st for WBUR On Tap as they talk about Julia's new interactive art project, Pathways to Freedom, that comes out later on this spring. The event is free, but registration is required, so go to WBUR.org/events to register. In the forecast, clear skies overnight tonight, down in the 20s. Tomorrow, more clouds than sun, right around the mid-30s. Sunshine for Sunday, though, back in the mid-30s. The time now is 5:51.
New book by Daniel Mallory Ortberg puts a feminist twist on old fairy tales. The author has also recently transitioned.
I was not sure that I was going to come out in time for the book tour, and one of the things that I was really anxious about was the thought of people saying, hey, a lot of shifting gender roles in your book. What's going on there? And having to say something like, oh, no reason?
That in the news in a busy week, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 8 on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
This is 90.9 WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins. The slim but stunning victory of a Democrat running for Congress in a Trump stronghold in Pennsylvania this week is something of a win for our congressman in Massachusetts. The winner of the Pennsylvania seat is Connor Lamb. Lamb is a veteran of the Marines, and so is Bay State Congressman Seth Moulton. Moulton was an early supporter of Lamb. Moulton raised money for him, campaigned for him, and says Lamb represents a new generation of leaders that the party desperately needs. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks explains why.
Last September, Seth Moulton went to Iowa to the Polk County Steak Fry, organized by the Polk County Democrats. Moulton's trip to the first presidential caucus state fueled speculation that he was considering a presidential run of his own. But back then, the Salem Democrats said he was in Iowa to advocate for a slate of fellow veterans and Democrats running for Congress.
12 veterans I've endorsed so far in swing districts across the country, exactly the districts we need to take back if we're going to take back the House. One of my messages here, there's help on the way, and it's coming in the form of a new generation of Democrats who understand public service and are going to start winning again.
Moulton's slate of endorsed candidates is now up to 19 veterans. Connor Lamb is one of them. Moulton raised nearly $80,000 for Lamb, campaigned door-to-door with him, and had six of his staff members working in Pittsburgh. That helped Lamb beat Rick Saccone, a four-term Pennsylvania state rep in a district that Donald Trump carried by 20 points in 2016.
Some people have credited me with recruiting some of these veterans to run, and there's a few that I did encourage.
Today, Seth Moulton talked to WBUR about Connor Lamb's victory.
But the best recruiter out there is our commander-in-chief, Donald Trump. He's the one who's convinced so many veterans to stand up and take on the Republican establishment, to take on the president and serve the country again.
Moulton is among many who call Lamb's victory a big defeat for President Trump and the Republicans. Lamb ran as a moderate Democrat, a Marine veteran who promised to oppose Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi and whose campaign ad featured a picture of him shooting an AR-15-style assault rifle.
Served 4 years in the Marines. Still loves to shoot. Became a federal prosecutor.
Some Republicans caution reading too much into Lamb's victory. Here's Dee Raga, treasurer of the Pennsylvania Republican Party, speaking earlier this week on Fox.
Lamb basically ran as a Republican. And the phrase that I would like to say is, here's a Lamb in Republican clothing. Lamb says he's pro-life, pro-gun. He says he's pro all of that.
It's a ridiculous attack line, like so many of the Republicans' attacks on him.
Again, Congressman Seth Moulton.
He has Democratic positions up and down the list, but they're positions that reflect the will of his district.
Connor Lamb is pro-gun rights, but in favor of universal background checks. Personally opposed to abortion, but unwilling to upend abortion rights. And supportive of medical marijuana. Boston-based Democratic consultant Dan Payne says these positions place Connor Lamb squarely among mainstream Democrats.
He opposed the Trump tax cut. He is for maintaining Obamacare. And if he was so close to the Republican Party and Trump, why did they spend $10 million trying to defeat him?
Payne is among many who say Lamb's victory signals a big challenge for Republicans as they try to hold on to their majorities in Congress in the age of Trump. Lamb's victory was fueled by an energized electorate that included college-educated suburban progressives and blue-collar labor. Seth Moulton says Lamb was a candidate who understood his district and that his experience as a veteran gave him credibility.
Now we have a new generation of leaders who have seen the consequences of failed leadership in Washington and places like Iraq or Afghanistan. I think you see the generation of veterans who went to Iraq and Afghanistan taking over for the generation that sent us there.
Moulton says veterans like Connor Lamb are in a unique position to challenge what's wrong with Washington, and he's hopeful they can help Democrats win in November. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.
Tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, which means parades, shamrocks, and Irish whiskey. It's a drink that has come back from near extinction. As the Washington Post reported earlier this month, Irish whiskey went from 60% of the world's whiskey to just 1% in the 1980s.
But even in the dark days, the distillers didn't just sit on their laurels. There was always the eye to the future and distilling for the future, so that when the sales would go up, we would have the liquid in hand.
That's Carol Quinn, archivist for Irish distillers. She says the drink's popularity has seen real highs and lows. It was a favorite of Queen Elizabeth I.
She was delighted with it. And at the time, it was known as Uisce Vathe, water of life.
And by the late 19th century, Irish whiskey had become a worldwide phenomenon.
I have records here of the sale of whiskey in the 1890s in Hong Kong, in Mauritius, in Venezuela, all across South America. There really wasn't a corner of the globe that Irish whiskey didn't reach to.
But then, two world wars and a trade war between Ireland and Britain shrank the industry. And in America, the drink developed a bad reputation during Prohibition when moonshiners passed off their swill as Ireland's famous drink.
For a lot of Americans, their first taste of what they believed to be Irish whiskey was this horrible, burning rot gut. I mean, it was foul stuff.
Today, Irish whiskey sales are once again strong, thanks largely to Americans. The U.S. is the largest export market. If you raise a glass tomorrow, count yourself lucky. For decades, the Irish couldn't touch the stuff on the holiday. An Irish law prohibited the opening of pubs on March 17th.
From 1927 onwards, when the Intoxicating Liquor Act was passed, St. Patrick's Day was a dry day here in Ireland. The pubs were forbidden to open, and they were forbidden to sell alcohol. So you can imagine going to visit the St. Patrick's Day parade in Dublin in the 1950s, and you're standing maybe on a rainy street, and you can't get a drop of whiskey anywhere for love nor money.
Nowadays, the whiskey pours freely in Ireland on March 17th. Sláinte.
Fair maids in the morning, bright and early, ushering down, do-do-da, white fall the daddy.
listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Subaru, committed to doing its part to make the world a better place by supporting philanthropic initiatives in local communities. Learn more at Subaru.com/lovepromise. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Farmers Insurance, committed to helping people understand the ins and outs of insurance so they can prepare for life's ups and downs. Coverage options and more information can be found at farmers.com. And Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets, manuals, and signage. Details at Staples stores or staples.com/copy and print. Staples, it's pro time.
From Boston University, you're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston, home of Boston's largest radio newsroom, 92.7 WBUA Tisbury, 89.1 WBUH Brewster, and streaming at WBUR.org. WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. The question now seems to be not whether President Trump will fire National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, but when. Today, the White House addressed the issue of staff turnover at the highest ranks.
You want the right people for the right time, and as policy priorities change, that means that sometimes you're going to have personnel change.
This is All Things Considered. Our story coming up. Good evening, I'm Lisa Mullins. Also ahead, when Russians head to the polls to vote for president on Sunday, thousands of election observers will be watching for fraud.
The use of biometrics is a game changer. It will make things a little bit easier, more efficient at an airport environment.
Also, setting the record straight, this week ProPublica retracted and apologized for inaccurate reporting about the woman nominated to lead the CIA. NPR quoted that report. And then on Marketplace, the EU threatens to retaliate with levies on American blue jeans, bourbon, and motorcycles. It's now 6:01. News headlines are next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly is trying to reassure staffers that there aren't any imminent personnel changes coming. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, this comes in a week when the Secretary of State was fired. The president's personal assistant was asked to leave suddenly, and rumors are swirling about other possible departures from the Trump administration.
It's not exactly normal for the press secretary to have to tweet a denial that the national security advisor is about to be out of a job, or for the chief of staff to call top aides in to tamp down rumors. But that's exactly what happened as the week closed out in the Trump White House. Here's Press Secretary Sarah Sanders describing Chief of Staff John Kelly's message to staff.
Reassuring them that there were no immediate personnel changes at this time, and that people shouldn't be concerned. We should do exactly what we do every day, and that's come to work and do the very best job that we can.
When asked whether the president offered those same assurances to cabinet secretaries currently embroiled in controversy, Sanders simply repeated, "We don't have any personnel changes at this time." Tamara Keith, NPR News, the White House.
Russian President Vladimir Putin is urging citizens to cast ballots in Sunday's election, though it's a race he is almost certain to win. In a televised address to the Russian people today, Putin saying the will of the people, the will of each Russian citizen, will determine the path the country will take. Putin has an 80% approval rating, is poised to win another six-year term against seven challengers, but the Kremlin hopes to avoid voter apathy and is seeking to boost turnout for the election. The young African-American man beaten in a Charlottesville parking garage at last summer's white nationalist rally has won acquittal today on the assault and battery charge he was facing. Hawes Spencer from member station WCVE has the story.
The trial concerned the moments before 20-year-old DeAndre Harris himself was pummeled. And rally organizer Jason Kessler is outraged by the verdict.
He bashed an old man over the head with a heavy metal object.
But for at least 50 supporters, including Lisa Wolfwork of Black Lives Matter, the verdict was justice.
This is a message to white supremacists that this strategy of coming into our community, luring people into violence, filming them, turning victims into aggressors will not work.
The judge found that Harris may have thought a friend was getting attacked. For NPR News, I'm Hawes Spencer in Charlottesville.
Employers appear to have been embarking on a bit of a hiring binge in January. The Labor Department reporting that its latest jobs opening survey, known as JOLTS, shows employers advertising 6.3 million jobs at the end of the month. That's the most since records dating back 17 years. The big demand for workers comes as the nation's unemployment rate is also at a 17-year low, 4.1%. An upend of the week on Wall Street, the Dow closed up 72 points to 24,946. The Nasdaq closed up a fraction. This is NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR in Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Two lawmakers have filed a bill to divest Massachusetts pension funds from weapon and ammunition manufacturers. The proposal also has the backing of the state treasurer, Deb Goldberg. She says it would send a clear message that Massachusetts stands with victims and survivors of gun violence. Representative Lori Ehrlich of Marblehead is one of the bill's co-sponsors.
We here in Massachusetts have some of the strongest gun safety policies in the country. It seems to make sense that we should not be protecting the state with one hand and enabling weapons manufacturers with the other.
The $71 billion pension fund currently has $5 million invested in weapons companies. The cost of attending Berklee College of Music in Boston is on the rise. The school's trustees have approved a 2.6% increase in tuition, fees, and room and board. The total cost of attending the school, including room and board, will increase to $62,500 a year. Berklee says it's also boosting the amount of scholarships and financial aid it hopes to offer. Organizers of the South Boston St. Patrick's Day Parade say they're working to preserve its traditional route for future years' festivities. Mayor Marty Walsh shortened the route for this Sunday's parade. He cited the recent snowfall and concerns about public safety. The South Boston Allied War Veterans Council says it disagrees with that decision, but will go along with it this time as it considers what to do about next year and beyond. The husband and wife owners of Porter Square Books in Cambridge are taking a step toward passing the business along to their employees. David Sandberg and Dina Martel have sold off half the share of the bookstore to a group of 9 senior staff members. Sandberg says that the couple is not retiring anytime soon, but wants the future owners to be people who care about the store.
Every business wants its employees to be invested figuratively in the success of their business, and this is a way to get them invested literally as well as figuratively.
The 9 staff members will have the chance to purchase the other half of Porter Square Books when the current owners retire. Celtics visit the Orlando Magic tonight. Bruins play Tampa Bay tomorrow. And in the forecast, nice starless skies tonight. Down in the 20s. Tomorrow, more clouds than sunshine, right about the mid-30s. Sunday, heavier on the sunshine, back in the mid-30s. 35 degrees now in the Boston area at 6 past 6.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Moscow, where I am gauging Russian reaction to all the news you've been following there in Washington this week.
Boy, good timing, Mary Louise. There's been a whole lot of that news about Russia over these last few days.
There has indeed. To review, there's the sanctions that we know the Trump administration imposed yesterday, which the Kremlin is displeased over because they continue to insist that they did not interfere in U.S. elections. Also, Ari, that they didn't carry out cyber attacks on the U.S. power grid. Oh, and by the way, they did not poison the former Russian spy and his daughter in Britain. That's
all
the line
that.
Here in Russia. No. And meanwhile, we got this whole presidential election going on. So we've got lots more on that later in the program. But let me hand it back to you for now for our weekly discussion about U.S. politics.
Okay. Looking forward to hearing more from you in a bit, Mary Louise. But first, for that weekly political discussion, we have Mary Catherine Hamm, senior writer at The Federalist. Hi there.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And also here in the studio, Kimberly Atkins, reporter and columnist at The Boston Herald. Hi again, Kimberly.
Hi there.
Let's start with that U.S.-Russia relationship and the sanctions that the White House announced this week. Do you think those sanctions, that acknowledgement by the Trump White House, shows that this president has finally caught up with his intelligence community and the agreement that Russia interfered with the 2016 elections? Kimberly?
I think not quite yet. I mean, you saw even after the announcement of these sanctions, which are the toughest sanctions that this administration has handed down against Russia so far, there still is not a willingness to say for certain unequivocally that Russia is a bad actor. You saw Sarah Huckabee Sanders still saying, well, it depends on what Russia does from here on in. You know, you saw the president not really talk about the sanctions or the actions that Russia has taken against the U.S., even when he was talking about the this poisoning in the UK that the U.S. issued a joint statement condemning. So it still seems to be a hesitancy there to fully embrace that.
Mary Catherine, how do you interpret these sanctions?
I mean, well, there are, well, first of all, it's a big step to recognize that not only have they gone past the disinformation campaign, but into actual infrastructure, which is a huge deal. And so to recognize that with actual action is big. I do think Trump is willing to admit that for a moment, and then he might change his mind later. Mm-hmm. Other folks in the administration, H.R. McMaster, Nikki Haley, even Mike Pompeo, who will now be Secretary of State, have been much harder on this line. So you've got this strange dichotomy where at times the Trump administration is quite tough on Russia substantively with closing a consulate in San Francisco or with these sanctions, but you do not have a united front because the leader is missing in action and has sometimes been far too kind to Putin.
Let's move on from the U.S. relationship with Russia to this dramatic week of staff changes, from the Secretary of State being fired in a tweet to a close personal aide to the president apparently being deemed a risk to national security and walked out of the White House. Last night, there were some headlines that the National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, was going to be ousted immediately, then maybe not so immediately this afternoon. Here's what Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said.
The chief of staff actually spoke to a number of staff this morning, reassuring them that there were no immediate personnel changes at this time and that people shouldn't be concerned.
At this time. Mary Catherine, how do you think this turmoil affects President Trump's agenda?
Well, I think it makes it hard to focus on something like, say, Infrastructure Week, which we've tried several times now.
Right.
Look, the Trump White House does operate differently, just as the Trump organization operates differently. This is how he likes to manage, and I'm not sure it's that effective. It's like the online dating app of White Houses. There's a lot of heat and fire, not a lot of thought about compatibility, very little vetting, and in the end, you get ghosted or texted to be dumped.
Or tweeted.
But yeah, it's not a great way of doing business, and I don't think it helps him actually move legislation and goals forward.
Kimberly, President Trump says this is how he enjoys working. So what's wrong with that?
Well, it is how he enjoys it. I think he is fine with this setup, even if the people around him are kind of flailing in this chaos. Remember, he came from The Apprentice. He likes being at the table and saying, you're fired. And I think he's more comfortable being in that position, going with his gut, with his instincts, than necessarily relying on people around him who later on, as we've seen in many instances, he can regret following other people's advice and wishing he would stuck to his own guns.
I will say often his second choice is a more compatible choice that actually ends up being more functional, a Kelly at chief of staff, and I think Pompeo likely at secretary of state. So there is that.
I also want to talk about this week's special election in Pennsylvania. On Tuesday, Connor Lamb, the Democrat, apparently just barely won this district that President Trump carried by more than 20 points. Kimberly, do you think this one special election should redefine the way Democrats and political observers go into the midterm elections?
I think they should pay careful attention to it. Look, I always say special elections are special. They are they measure what's happening on the ground more than the national feeling. But in this sense, there's a lot to draw from it. There is an anti-Trump sentiment that can be palpable here. It's about choosing good candidates. Connor Lamb seemed to be the perfect candidate for this district at this time. And it brings in, you know, this idea of how strong Trump will be if he's going out on the campaign trail for the midterms like he promises he will. Will this be a get out the vote effort for the Democrats?
Yeah.
It's really a lot of things at play here. And I think both parties need to pay careful attention to that race.
The line we heard this week from Republicans like House Speaker Paul Ryan was that the Democrat ran as a Republican, as a conservative. Mary Catherine, does that give any consolation to the Republicans who appear to have lost this race?
Look, he did run as a moderate Democrat, and I do think that's something Democrats should pay attention to. Notably, he was not picked by primary, so it wasn't progressive activists and that energy that was working on his behalf. It was, you know, committee sort of chairman who did that, and I think that's how you got a more moderate candidate. But what you can't ignore is that the swing away from Republicans toward Democrats in every special election has been uniform, right? That's the problem for Republicans. There's a real issue there, and they can't rely on Democrats to pick two liberal candidates in every single race.
Just briefly in our last minute, in Washington and across the country this week, we saw students walk out of school to protest gun violence. Do you both think we're seeing a new political movement here, or is this just a moment?
I think we're seeing a cultural change. I think people are finally looking at guns and gun violence, particularly in schools, in a new way that can help change sentiment. I don't think that can come from the Capitol, from lawmakers. I think it comes from communities, and these students are an example of that.
Last word, Mary Catherine.
Yeah, I think the question is always whether this is social media and media fire but doesn't actually lead to change? I think that's the question. And as a lifelong contrarian, I'm also worried about dissenting voices. And when you're up against the behemoth of your school administration sort of pushing this and national media pushing it, my best wishes to those who might have disagreements on these policies and not walk out or walk with a different sign. I support them as well.
Mary Catherine Hamm, senior writer at The Federalist, thanks very much for joining us. And Kimberly Atkins, reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald. Good to have you both here.
Thanks. Always a pleasure.
Now, a correction to a story we aired Wednesday about Gina Haspel, the woman President Trump plans to nominate for director of the CIA. We spoke with a reporter for ProPublica who'd investigated Haspel's role at a secret CIA prison where terrorism suspects were interrogated. Last night, ProPublica retracted key details of that report. To correct the record, we spoke today with ProPublica's editor-in-chief, Stephen Engelberg.
Any suggestion that she had a direct or personal involvement in the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah, which is quite an infamous thing in the history of intelligence, you know, he was waterboarded some 83 times, that would not be correct. The chief of base turns out to have been a different person, and so any suggestion that she was directly and personally involved in that is incorrect.
In fact, Gina Haspel became chief of base at the prison in Thailand after Abu Zubaydah's waterboarding. ProPublica now reports that she was present for the interrogation of a different detainee who was waterboarded 3 times. There are still questions about her role in the destruction of tapes showing Abu Zubaydah's waterboarding. The ProPublica journalist Raymond Bonner based his incorrect account on 3 sources he believed were knowledgeable. This week, people who worked with Haspel began to defend her, including James Mitchell, a psychologist and CIA contractor involved in the Abu Zubaydah interrogation. Some of the ProPublica reporting was based on his book, Enhanced Interrogation. Today, Mitchell spoke to me about the retracted ProPublica report saying Haspel mocked Abu Zubaydah's physical reaction to the interrogations.
That's completely untrue. I mean, it's 100% untrue. They mischaracterized the event. They misattributed who I was referring to. I know who I was writing about, and I know the incident that I was writing about, and she wasn't involved in it.
Mitchell explained why, on this occasion, he felt the need to speak out.
I'm doing it in this particular case because they were using something that I wrote to smear a woman who is the best choice that this nation could have for that position.
Before the story was first published last February, ProPublica asked the CIA for comment, and the agency responded that nearly every element of the story was inaccurate in whole or part, but would not specify which elements. Here's Engelberg of ProPublica.
That kind of blanket statement is sometimes, or indeed often, delivered by people who are, not being honest in what they're saying. You know, there's some very small error somewhere, and they're saying, well, the story has errors, so, we deny it. And in this case, what was going on was very different. They were trying to steer us away from a story that was incorrect. I guess you'd have to ask them why on earth they wouldn't just say she wasn't there.
Today, I put that question to Dean Boyd, a CIA spokesperson, and he told me he thought the agency's on-the-record statement was quite clear.
I will just say that we do operate in a difficult situation where we are not able to comment on specific details that may or may not be classified. We can push back strongly, and I think this was a pretty clear indication that there were errors in the story, but in many cases we're not able to go into much more detail given classification issues.
I asked ProPublica's Engelberg how he views this major lapse in the context of a long journalistic career.
Well, you know, when we cover medicine, we talk about sometimes what they call never events, you know, like operating on the wrong limb. I believe in journalistic practice, this is a never event. This should never happen. And I would never accept the notion that this is just something that's going to happen from time to time.
That's Stephen Engelberg, editor-in-chief of ProPublica, which has retracted significant portions of its reporting on Gina Haspel.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Start your day tomorrow with Morning Edition. Simply say to your smart speaker, play WBUR as you're getting ready for your day. Or if you just want good company.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Applied Biomath, applying mechanistic mathematic modeling, simulation, and analysis to accelerate and de-risk drug R&D. More at AppliedBiomath.com. And Tufts University's Gordon Institute, re-engineering the MBA for tech professionals. Earn your master's in engineering management in as little as 2 years. Gordon.tufts.edu.
This is 90.9 WBUR. A Boston-based New Balance has won a $17 million contract to provide sneakers to the military. The Defense Department is required to give preference to American-made products when making purchases. The contract will provide work for the New Balance plants in Boston and in Maine. For the first time in a decade, L.L. Bean is not giving worker bonuses. The struggling outdoor retailer in Maine says it will eliminate 100 jobs early next month. 500 workers have already taken voluntary early retirement. L.L. Bean said today its annual revenue for the past year was nearly flat. On Wall Street today, U.S. stocks ended up gaining ground for the day. The Dow finished up 0.29%, about 73 points, to close at 24,947. S&P gained 0.17% to close at 2752, and the NASDAQ ended right where it began, 7482. It's 19 past 6.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Greeno, helping you tell your brand story through the science of marketing and the art of storytelling. GreenOUGH.biz. And Forestdale Park Senior Living, now open in Malden, with independent and assisted living and Compass Memory support, all on one campus. Learn more, ForestdalePark.com.
Let's get the weekend weather forecast with meteorologist Dave Goldbaum.
Skies will clear out tonight. It'll be cold with a low near 25 by morning. For Saturday, considerable cloudiness, some intervals of sunshine at times, high 34. Sunshine for Sunday, still chilly, high again 34. Sunny on Monday, mid-30s. Clouds increase Tuesday with the chance for some snow Tuesday night with highs in the upper 30s.
35 degrees now in Boston. This is WBUR.
WBUR supporters include the Peabody Essex Museum, now presenting the critically acclaimed exhibition Georgia O'Keeffe Art, Image, Style, extended through April 8th, PEM.org. And Welch & Forbes, customized investment portfolios, private trustees, and family office services since 1838. WelchForbes.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Moscow. It's just days before the Russian presidential election, and the office of Golos is jam-packed. Golos is the Russian word for voice. It also means vote, a fitting name for an independent election watchdog group. Every surface here is buried under pamphlets for volunteers, boxes of voting guides.
Should I speak English?
Roman Udot helps run Golos. He invited me to his office to talk about what it means to observe an election in Russia.
Let me show you. Okay.
I'll just explain. We're just watching on your laptop here. And you are pulling up. This is video of a polling station in 2016. Where are we? Moscow?
Yeah, it's Kazan region.
The minutiae of voting in Russia will sound familiar if you've ever voted in America. People here in Russia generally cast their ballots at a school or another public building near their home. They put a check next to their preferred candidate's name, then slip the paper through a slot into a secure ballot box. At least, that is how it's supposed to work. He's putting his ballot down into the ballot box. He walks away.
Behold.
In from the right.
Behold.
More people are put. Oh my God, they've just opened the ballot box.
They took it from under their clothes. They stuff it, stuff it, and stuff it.
It's 1, 2, 3, 4 people pulling ballots out of jackets.
And the reaction of the commission, reaction of the chair of the commission.
Now, each polling place has a government-mandated security camera that rolls nonstop on election day. But the tapes rarely see the light of day. So Golos depends on whistleblowers to send in footage that shows fraud. Or people can send pictures or call a toll-free number. Golos also deploys volunteer election observers, thousands of them, all over the country to keep an eye on polling places. When you're watching for fraud, when you're watching for falsification, is that how it tends to happen? Just more ballots are getting counted than people had showed up to vote?
You'll see that it is a ballot box stuffing, multiple voting. You multiple vote on one given polling station or merry-go-round carousel when people goes from polling station to polling station, and we have videos.
This was not the work that Golos set out to do. When the group was formed in 2000, they were a bunch of statistics wonks, collecting raw data on voter turnout and writing reports based on that data. But 2000 was the same year that Vladimir Putin was first elected president. And Roman Udot says that each year since that election, reports of fraud have increased. Those math wonks, they couldn't trust the data anymore. And so Golos got a new mission.
We observe the growing level of falsification. We can prove that and with facts. We can prove that with statistical data. We're sort of a watchdog, and we began to draw attention to bug. And that sound was very unpleasantly received by the government. Of course, they are not happy when we are showing the problems in elections, because elections are the source of their power.
Elections are the source of the regime's power. Make elections seem free and fair, win by wide margins, and you've got a mandate to govern. You've also got incentive to shut down independent groups like Golos. The day after we spoke with Roman Udot, the group was evicted from a call center they had set up in another neighborhood. The landlord told Udot, "We have no choice. They made us do it." So this Sunday, if you live in Moscow, if you live in precinct 1096, this is where you're going to come vote. They are ready for about 1,500 voters. I'm at this neighborhood school with Irina Belia, a sweet-looking grandmother in her early 70s. She runs this polling station. On Sunday, she'll get to the school at 7 a.m., 1 hour before the polls open. She'll organize the ballots, inspect the list of registered voters, set up the table where she'll oversee what's going on. Irina Belia will be watching, but she will be watched as well. Election observers, like the ones Golos sends all over the country, pay close attention to the people who run precincts. Belia gets it, because she used to be an election observer herself. It is cold out, about 25 degrees in front of this school, so we head to Balia's apartment nearby.
Okay, she wants to take us on a tour of her house.
So all pictures of her?
Это мы с мужем.
This is her and her husband.
After the grand tour, we settle in at her dining room table to chat. Balia is walking me through the nuts and bolts of voting in Russia when it becomes clear she has quite a story about volunteering during the 2011 parliamentary elections.
We were observers, but we were not truly allowed to observe. They kept us out of the way, so we couldn't see anything. But then I accidentally passed a ballot box, and I witnessed the vice president of the committee stuffing 23 ballots into one of the boxes. I tried grabbing them from him, but he pushed me away. So I kept trying, and finally I was able to snatch them from him. But he cut his hand, and blood spilled on the ballots and on the floor. It looked like a thriller scene.
And so what did you do? You complained?
Yes, of course. I was holding the ballots in my hands, and I was afraid to put them down. The people who ran the polling station approached me. They wanted me to hand them the ballots, but I refused. I said I will give them only to a court official. Even the police came up to me, but I said, I won't give them to you. I'll give them only to the judge.
Belia took the bloody ballots to the courts, but the prosecutor refused to look into what had happened. She continues to speak out about what she witnessed at the polling station that day in 2011. I ask, does that put her in danger? This soft-spoken grandma stares me in the eye and raises her fists in the air.
I recall a passage from the book Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, where he wrote, "Why did those arrested on the streets? Why didn't they shout? They were told, 'Hush, hush, get into the car,' and then they disappeared." And when that member of the committee told me the same words, 'Hush, hush, don't shout,' I said out loud, 'Oh, you think this is shouting? I will show you what shouting is.' I went to the center of the room and started screaming. Here, here, look. I think that the way you combat fraud and you fight lies is by speaking up."
In 2013, Belia decided to take the job running her local polling place. It's a government-funded position. The pay is about $1 an hour. The work is part-time. Pelia figured if she couldn't get authorities to care about fraud as an election watcher, she'd try to prevent the fraud in the first place by being in charge. Like nearly everyone else we've talked to in Moscow, Pelia has no doubts about who will win on Sunday. So why get involved with the process? Why vote at all?
Can one person make a difference? Everyone says, I cannot change anything on my own. That's what the majority thinks.
Not voting is giving up, she says, and she is not ready to give up just yet. Irina Pelia, she'll be in charge this weekend at Moscow Voting Precinct 1096.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Tonight, the Celtics are likely to be without Kyrie Irving when they play Orlando. Kyrie Irving is out with a sore knee for a second game, but Al Horford is expected to be back on the court. Boston Bruins play the Tampa Bay team tomorrow. In the forecast, a cold night ahead, but a clear one as clouds move out down in the mid-20s by tomorrow morning. Some clouds return for tomorrow, though the sun should make a few cameo appearances, highs about 34. Sunday, fewer clouds, more sun, still stuck in the mid-30s. Make the most out of your car, even when it's time to replace it, by donating it to WBUR. You'll be supporting the news, and you may be eligible for a tax deduction as well. Find out how at wbur.org/cars. And thanks a lot. It's now 6:30, and Marketplace is next.